everybody. The meeting is called to order. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Cook has a statement tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State and required in Chapter 551 the government service referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. I will now call and start right away with the Finance Committee. I'll call it to order. Let's see here. Follow my script. The first order of business is the approval of previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Okay. Bivens and Brown. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Any opposed? Thank you. I appreciate that. Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, land and water plan update. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our finance staff are preparing the fiscal year 2007 annual financial report that is due to the comptroller's office by November 20th. In other words, how we ended up in FY07. And the budget staff are preparing fiscal year 2008 operating budget to be submitted to the Legislative Budget Board and the Governor's Office by December the 3rd. Both reports are on schedule to be submitted to the oversight agencies by the deadline. We continue to spend a considerable amount of time throughout the agency on our SAO work and the fiscal recommendations related to the state audit. And Mr. Bork will be providing you a detailed report on that shortly. I'm pleased to report that we have had a good start on our revenues this year, although we're really not far enough into the year to do a whole lot of reporting on it. Our hunting and fishing license sale, and I have sent several of the graphs to you to keep you posted on how that's going. Our hunting and fishing license sales for 2008 are running at $49.3 million as of the end of October, and that's a 4% increase from prior year sales. And last year, you recall, was better than the year before that. This is the two primary contributors to this increase are freshwater fishery and super combo license sales. We've not received the consolidated partner report for October yet, but we opened the fiscal year well with state park fees at $2.7 million at the end of September, which is a 7% increase over prior years. Mayor Fields, again, will keep us updated on this, on the financial situation and our progress there, and we'll present a financial overview to the commission in our January meeting. By then, we'll have enough numbers that you can kind of hang your hat on. I'm also pleased to report, Mr. Chairman, that in the election yesterday, and I'm sure you've all heard this, is something that we've worked very hard on to make sure people understood what was in Proposition 4. Proposition 4, along with all of the other propositions, I understand, passed. Prop 4 passed at a percentage of 58% to 42%. Just in a nutshell, that included $52 million for Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, $25 million in the battleship, and $27 million in our state park repair program. So we are pleased with that. Now we just have to get all the hoops jumped through and the process moving in order to put those dollars to work. Thank you,
sir. Bob, can I talk a little bit about appropriate that those dollars when they're actually appropriated?
I think Scott will fill you in on the exact dates there, but bottom line, it's quite a process that you've got to go through with LBB, with the public finance group, and could take several months. We'll provide you a good detail on that shortly.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions about any of that? And I think we'll be discussing quite a bit of it as we go through the next few minutes. Committee item number two, proposed stamp and print artwork program. Ms. Frances Stiles and Mr. Martin Wood, will you please make your presentation? Thank you.
Good
Julie Lennon and Frank McKellen, and with the Administrative Resource Division. Each year, according to the contract with our print program, the Woods comes to us and brings us the artwork for review. We have 9 pieces of artwork. This artwork is reviewed by you and approved for this group. And then we take this and make it into the collector set of stamps and all of that to for sale to our official population. A portion of the sale of prints from Mr. Wood comes back to us in royalties. This year we have the following, and I'm going to let Mr. Wood introduce the artwork that we have here.
The Magistrate Bird Stamp is done by Jim Hoffman. He's a Minnesota artist who has won the Federal Oak Stamp 3 times, and I think this is the 3rd time that he's done our Texas Oak Stamp program. Sure, interestingly, I suppose to me it is, he has 2 other brothers. Collectively, they have won 8 Federal Oak Stamp prints in the last 16 or 17 years. I mean, one of his brothers won the Federal Oak Stamp this year. Don Gage Stamp is by Bruce Miller, a Minnesota artist who has also won the Federal Duck Stamp several years ago with Lou Heron. The pheasant is the subject matter we chose for the Upland Stamp, and that is done by Jim Halton's brother, Bob, who has won the Federal Duck Stamp twice. The Freshwater Stamp is a striper by Don Gray, who is at least a couple of times previously done our saltwater stamp. And of course the saltwater stamp is done by Texas artist Herb Booth, who is, I think this is his 3rd entry. I'd be glad to try to answer your questions.
Well, Bobby Yost did a good job, but now how many Texas artists? We just have the one?
We have the one.
Okay. You try to put emphasis on Texas artists I can't remember.
Yeah, but sure. And in fact, at some time, several years ago, I was amazed at how many Texas artists. I can't remember the number, but certainly a number of artists that I'm more than comfortable with. The fact of the matter is, duck stamp art and collecting of it is really an autograph contest. And a very poor painting by David Moss, if he was capable of doing a poor painting, would sell better than the greatest painting ever painted by me. Because the dealers and the collectors, you know, they're comfortable with the name, John P. Cowan, the Hawkman, Larry Hayden, who did our first stamp. By the way, Larry Hayden died about a year ago, and that's the first Texas artist that has passed away. He did the first Texas Duck Stamp, and he did about the 12th Texas Duck Stamp, but he passed away about a little over a year ago, and I didn't report that last year, and I was remiss in not doing that. He was a great artist. Certainly started that program. The first Texas Duck Stamp at the time was the largest selling limited edition print ever published, larger than any Federal Duck Stamp print. And of course, it spawned another 20 states to have a duck stamp program, not having 22 million crazy Texans that wanted to support the program, and not having 80% of the ducks in the Central Flyway. You know, the state of Kansas just thought they'd have a duck stamp print, you know. And it didn't, and most of those states don't even produce prints anymore. I mean,
it didn't work for them.
Really, in a lot of the states, the state doesn't get a royalty, so there's just no incentive for them, you know. And the contest is a bunch of hassle. You got one winner, and
everybody else
mad. Exactly. Interestingly enough, there is, to my mind, and I think I'm still correct about this, there has been one Texas artist win a duck stamp contest. You know, people think this is a win here. This is not a win. Particularly with respect to the Texas duck stamp program, back in 1981, the commission gave the high bidder, luckily us, that the ability to pick who we wanted and the subject matter that we wanted on the duck stamp contest. And that's the real key. You know, back to 22 million or 26 million crazy Texans is what makes the Texas duck stamp program so successful. You know, because we have ongoing success program the way it used to be, but the duck stamp business is one of attrition. And, you know, we've held on to more business than any other state by a bunch. Certainly the state of Texas has made more money, I don't know how much. over the course of the year in Wallabies, and it's been a great deal for us, and I hope you guys think it's been a great deal for you. You know, it's not as great as it was, but it's, you looking at these numbers, it's, you know, still significant amount of money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Any questions for both? Francis, one thing, yeah, can we certainly look at that history? Maybe you can get something to the commission about how many dollars we've raised over the years. I think it'd be interesting.
You know, I would say this one thing, and I know I've said this before, I've certainly said it in private before, Parks and Wildlife does lots of great things. The one thing it doesn't do, although it seems to be doing better, is take full advantage of tooting your own horn. And this duck stamp program is absolutely second to none.
Right.
Not necessarily because of us, but it really is the blue chip of the deal. And to use those images more and more in your publications and stuff, and you own the copyright to them, it's just crazy not to promote that. Lydia, in fact, showed me a piece that was sent out to all the combo license holders that featured the duck stamp on the back. And to my knowledge, I don't know if that's ever been done before, but at least it's a start.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with you.
You know, once we made this not required to put on the license, once the commission made this not required to license, I think that was back in 1995 or 1960, when we went to automated licenses, that pretty well, really, it would have driven the stake in the heart of any other duck stamp program except the Texas duck stamp program. And it certainly has, you know, made the stamps less collectible because they're really not required to hunt. And that, you know, that's sort of the key to all of this. Hey, it's, you know, this is got to be put on your life. And it really, really hurts sales. You know, I'm sure the benefits far outweigh that matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or to sell our customers.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What I need is the state to pass a law where every art buyer in the state of Texas has to come in my store one day a year. You know?
Yeah, I understand.
I hear these dealers complaining about that, you know, the inconvenience of it all. Please pass a law.
Really?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, if you have to get 10% of the state, you know, or whatever, please pass a law for every art buyer in the country has to come in my store.
We'll work on it.
Good.
Yeah, Brandy, any other comments?
No, sir. This will be provided to you tomorrow for approval.
Any other discussion or questions with our little friends? I'll place this item on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you both.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to comment. Thank you, Mr. Wood. He has been a friend of Parks and Wildlife, as you know, a long, long time, and worked with staff. It's a pleasure to work with you, and once you kind of get past that bashfulness that he has.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Doug. Item number 3, implementation of recommendations by the State Auditor's Office, Auditor State Parks Financial Processing, status update. Scott Moore, I believe.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Moore, Deputy Executive Director of Operations for the Parks and Wildlife. Particularly for the benefit of the new commissioners who have not been involved in this process, I'm going to take a little bit longer today to report a little bit on the history of the SAO process as well as our progress towards implementing recommendations. I'll try to make it fairly brief. To start out with, as most of you are aware, prior to the last session, we had identified some funding issues in state parks. We're trying to move forward to remedying those funding issues. State Parks Division had come forward to us in years prior and had identified some issues within their division relative to financial controls and management and other issues, and some of those were related to the funding shortfalls. And if you look back over several bienniums in the state parks, what you will see is a relatively static revenue stream and at the same time pretty dramatically increasing operational costs out there. And that really was the genesis of the problem. The fact is revenues were not going up in proportion to the number of expenses that were incurred within the state parks division. ultimately, in both 2003 and then really in 2005, it became fairly critical. In 2003, we riffed, in state terminology, we released 19 positions in state parks. We cut that many staff. And then even more critically, in 2005, the trend continued as expenses went up. Gasoline, obviously, you're all aware of the increased costs there and others. We were forced in 2005 to release another 73 staff people from the state parks division. So we were closing in on 100 folks that were cut out of the workforce to about 1,000 or 1,100. So about one-tenth of the workforce was cut. It also precipitated the need to partially close 52 of our state parks, roughly half, not quite half, but close to half, partially. We did make an effort to not completely close any parks, so all parks remained open to some extent, but we reduced hours in many parks. We stopped being open Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday for some of those parks. We had some locations around the state, like Lake Somerville, where you had two units on one lake, and we would close one unit and leave the other unit open. So pretty dramatic cuts in operations and cuts in staff occurred starting in 2003 and really came to a head in 2005. Which then prompted our move to go to the legislature in 2007 and ask for increased funding to try to remedy some of those problems. And as background, the internal audit group here at Texas Parks and Wildlife had done an internal audit in October 2006, which really reflected many of the recommendations which were ultimately identified subsequently by the state auditor's office in their report a little bit later. So, many of the issues were apparent to the agency prior to the audit. We appreciated the audit. We took it seriously. It did endorse the fact that what we knew was real, and they did help us identify some new problems. And this report this morning is going to talk to you about the resolution of those problems. In December of 06 through February of 06, the state auditor's office sent 16 folks out here to conduct a formal audit of the state parks divisions and associated support functions. The new commissioners, I might remind you that Fund 64, which is the state park fund, Parks and Wildlife, is not only used to fund the state parks division, but also used to fund some of the support divisions, particularly the infrastructure division, communications, AR, administrative resources, and information technology. Those groups do work for state parks partially, so part of their funding comes from Fund 64, and they were looked at also in this audit. Any Fund 64 dollars were looked at. The objectives were to determine whether the budget projections for state parks and the upcoming budget at that point, which was the 06-07 budget, were reasonable and supported, and to examine the deferred maintenance issues that were facing the parks. Because as you may well know, along with the rifts and the partial closures, we had a building backlog of major critical repairs that were going unaddressed. In March 2007, the auditors issued their report. The report had four major categories, which I'll go into in just a moment. Around the same time or shortly thereafter, at the close of the legislature, there were several riders that basically reflected some of the recommendations. Cook asked us to put together a team along with the chairman, and Mr. Cook asked us to move forward aggressively in addressing all the recommendations and the related SAO riders. The agency did some pretty dramatic, took some pretty dramatic action. We created in the Administrative Resource Division a State Parks Revenue Branch, an entirely new branch. Staffed it with some of our best and brightest. I think there are 7 or 8 FTEs in that branch, which are accountants and statisticians, and their sole objective in life is to make sure that we're tracking and appropriately reporting on our revenues in state parks, as well as helping us look at new revenue opportunities. We created a suite of teams, I believe it was 25, might have been 26 teams, that broke out to look at the specific recommendations and to go beyond that. And I think that's important. We took this series so seriously that we didn't just go back and do a point-by-point report on what they had asked us. We looked at the bigger picture. We tried to take a holistic perspective, and we tried to put this thing together in a business manner that made sense and would be credible downtown as we moved into the next session. We had the first report was due on July the 1st this year. It was a pre-progress report. We submitted it 3 days early. We got positive feedback from the auditor's office about that response, our intended response to the recommendations. The second report went in August the 31st. It was submitted on time. And at this point, we're on a quarterly reporting basis. Our next report is due at the end of December. We plan at this point to begin to submit those reports early. Kind of caught up and got past the curve. There were 48 recommendations totally spread across the four categories. 36 of the recommendations have been completed. The question comes to me occasionally, does that mean we're three quarters of the way through? If you do simple math, and the answer is that's hard to answer, probably not. Some of the recommendations, as I said, were well known to us. We had already been working on the solutions, and they didn't take a whole lot of work to complete them. Some of the recommendations are going to require a significant workload and won't be completed for another year or a year and a half. The time of way, the relative value of the recommendations is not an exercise we undertook, but for purposes of reporting, we have finished 36 of 48 recommendations. We still have some important work to do, and we're proud of the work that's been done, and I'll go over some of that in a minute. We will complete the 48 recommendations and the associated 118 deliverables if we win in a professional project management model to identify specific deliverables for each of the recommendations. We track those on a weekly basis. We have weekly team meetings. We have put together an SAO response team, which reviews all responses and coordinates them, puts them together in a way that's palatable and makes sense as you put them into reports, so it doesn't look like the report was written by 35 different folks. As of the time we put this slideshow together, we can document in excess of 20,000 hours that we've booked against these recommendations and their solutions. So this is an agency-wide project, particularly includes state parks, the infrastructure division, administrative resources, and information technology. I applaud their efforts to get this done and take it seriously. The four major areas, the first area was to improve the accuracy of park visitation reporting and maximize state park revenue. Clearly, the intent here was to make sure we could count our visitors and we could tie the revenues to visitation, and that we should be looking for ways to increase the revenue to try to support the state park system. I'm not going to necessarily go over each one of these. You have the package. We'd be glad to specifically talk to you offline if you wish about real detail. Suffice it to say that under visitation, this is something that we struggled with for a long time. There's been a lot of work put into here. We have standardized our visitation data collection procedures. We have ordered consistent hardware. For example, we have many different kinds of car counters that are used to count after hours visitation of parks. If your car rolls over the counter, it counts cars, and then you use a formula to extrapolate how many folks are coming in after hours. We went out and purchased machines that are consistent so that each park has the same machine and uses the same kind of technology. This makes it much more reliable and valid than using 12 different kinds of counters. We actually now are going through a head count in each park, so when you come into the park, rather than using a formula, which we used to use to guesstimate during the hours when we have staff available, we're actually counting the number of folks that come in. There are policies and procedures that have been developed that are homogeneous across all the parks rather than having multiple different systems. We have one system that each park uses now, and so the data is much more reliable. We have developed state park specific, site specific visitation plans, and we have gone through extensive efforts to train the staff on how to implement those plans, how to do the consistent head counts, how to report the information back to the Integrated Administrative Resources Division, and those kinds of things. We've gone out at the request of SAO. One of the recommendations was to conduct some web-based customer preference surveys. What do the customers want out there? We have completed those. We contracted with a reputable survey group that has come in and made some recommendations to us about hours and kinds of things that the staff, that the visitors want to see in the parks, and we're in the process of evaluating how to implement those recommendations. The last bullet you see here is an important one. This was not a recommendation of the SAO. They did not come in and say develop a site-specific strategic business plan for each park. This is one of the things where we decided this made good sense for the agency. Any organization ought to have a good business strategic plan. So we've gone out and each park developed a site-specific strategic strategic business plan for that park, which encapsulates many things that we're going to talk about this morning. This is, by the way, this picture is representative of some of the intensive training. 239 of the state park staff have gone through the physical control and management training processes that we've implemented, as well as the management components. Walt and his staff have put together, prior to the SAO report, a managing park operations training program, which they have put several hundred of their staff through management and operations training. So we've been pretty serious about this. Second big category was to improve the effectiveness of management and operations of state parks. We have put together, once again, a homogenous one model for implementing budget monitoring procedures and protocols. Before we had a hodgepodge, you might find five or six different models out there across the park system, made it hard for us to pull data together. The second one is a lot of words for saying we figured out how we're going to analyze when and how to reduce services that are driven necessary again in the future. To make some good business decisions, you don't want to impact your revenue. You can help it when you have to have partial closures and those kinds of things. We have embedded in all the individual performance plans of the state park staff and the management staff, individual performance plans that require them to comply to fiscal management controls and operational controls. And we have implemented the land transaction policy that was required. Specifically, the land transaction policy required that we notify the governor's office 6 months in advance if there's going to be a full closure or transfer of the state park. It also required what we already had in place. A couple of years ago, we put in place the requirement to come to you folks on two different occasions as we move forward with any land sales. Transactions, they go through two commission meetings, and that there's plenty of opportunity for the public to have opportunity to give feedback before those sales or transfers are consummated. So we got that in writing in the policy. Third big area was improve the consistency of cost estimating processes and ensure proper prioritization of capital improvement and repair needs. This has to do specifically with our infrastructure division and how we are going to spend the capital money that the legislature gave us. And Mr. Wilson and I will talk a little bit more later about some of the specifics of how that's going to happen. But related to the SAO, though, we do have some major accomplishments here. We had a capital project justification methodology. We went back and enhanced that policy, revised it, came up with some pretty specific justification methodologies. Try to go into detail here, so I'll be willing to do that later if you're interested. Probably the most important, and you folks will remember that at the last commission meeting, we came to you with this third bullet here, which we were required to develop a weighted project priority system using approved criteria, and I approved them by the commission. And so we came up with these four criteria that you see in front of you. Obviously, health and safety is of paramount importance to us and our customers. Regulatory compliance is second priority. Business continuity, and that's a fancy way for saying we're going to do this right in terms of having our money and our expenditures. We're going to use approved business and accounting practices. And last but certainly not least, our mission support. We're going to continue to support our mission as we spend these dollars trying to provide opportunities for recreation and conservation within the system. The final category is by far the most important. Specifically, it's to ask us to address the financial control weaknesses in state parks. Probably the most comprehensive thing that we did there is to develop a state parks fiscal control plan. This is a plan that requires a lot of filling out of paperwork, a lot of oversight internally so that multiple people sign off on financial transactions, reporting back to the Administrative Resources Division, and particularly the new financial branch within Administrative Resources, so there's oversight from another division here with expertise in financial management. We put together an administrative handbook that has been disseminated, and all staff have been trained on in terms of these administrative and fiscal responsibilities, and a new fee collection handbook. I'll go over some of these in a little bit more detail here in a minute. Most importantly, we have implemented a comprehensive fiscal control policy and have trained, as I said, I believe 329 staff. This training was put on by the Administrative Resources Division with support from State Parks, where we actually went out into the field in four different sessions and had a week-long, 2 days, week-long training session. These folks were intensively trained on how to use these financial control processes. They are labor intensive, and I'm going to talk about that. We do have a plan to try to reduce that labor intensive work as we move into the future. But right now, we are pleased with the fiscal control. What feedback we've received has been positive about its effect. We are taking it seriously. When we run into those few staff who have some opposition to it, we are dealing with that quickly and making sure that this is a part of the culture in the field to get this done correctly. Each site now has its own approved, and when I say approved, by the Administrative Resources Division and their staff have approved each of the site's fiscal control plans that ensures adequate oversight of our financial parts. We've gone back and looked at the way we do concessions revenue reporting. We, once again, one of the problems we had there is it was a little bit different from site to site, so now it's not. Same forms are used so that we collect the data quickly and it's much more reliable. Each site now has a revenue goal for 2008. This is very important. This is one of the things that the legislature asked us to look at, increasing revenues. Mary Fields and her team have been very helpful in trying to help us figure out how we could look at increasing revenues. So each site now has a revenue goal for 2008 that's written into the performance plans of the managers. I will say, as an aside, that we're trying to be reasonable about these goals. Oftentimes, revenues in state parks are not necessarily driven by the staff there. They're driven sometimes by the weather, for example. The weather's bad on the weekends, it's not necessarily to do with people coming out there. So we try to take those things into consideration and use a practical approach to projecting potential revenue bills from the park. And the park doesn't make them in any given year. They're required, for example, to report on why. What happened? What was the cause? At least there's been some ability to analyze whether it was because of weather or because of some other performance issue. We've also completed the assessment of state park staff business and financial management skills. This was a report that we asked Mr. Bingham and the Human Resources Division to perform. Basically, they did a survey of all the state park staff, and not surprisingly, what they found is that state park staff are typically not trained in business and financial management. On the other hand, I think the survey identified that there was a lot of sensitivity to business and financial issues. There was a lot of willingness for training, and so we are in the process right now of putting together training programs for key staff in the field that will enhance their business and financial skills along with the existing recreational and customer service skills that most of them have. There are a handful of riders. Rider 23 asked us to develop standard definition for health and safety repair needs, which we have done. It's based on a formula which I will not try to articulate here. It's fairly complex. It really does take into consideration, and when we say health and safety, I want to make it perfectly clear, we do not operate in sites that pose a health and safety danger to our customers. That's the case, we close the facility, we stop operations, and we immediately begin repairs. But we'll propose what health and safety to us means is we're looking forward. We're looking at the future, and if there is some potential in the near future or something to create a health safety issue, hit close to the top immediately. We don't want to get in a position where we have to close the facility because there's something dangerous out there. We are required by the rider to do weekly monitoring of those kind of issues, and we have a system that does that. We have a facility management system that we've had for several years. We've added a component to that. If you're in the field and you see something that could become an imminent danger, it gets addressed immediately. This rider also required us to redirect about $100,000 in previous FTEs from Central Administration's park budget support. That's been accomplished. It asked us to develop an annual state parks performance report, which we've done. We will be reporting annually. This rider also was responsible for us moving staff out of state parks into appropriate divisions. There were a few financial type staff that we moved to Mary Field Shop and Administrative Resources. I believe there were three or so folks that were moved into information technology. There were IT professionals that were in state parks. So it asked us, and we thought it was a reasonable ask to realign those people with the divisions that they wanted and it's been accomplished early on. For many years, we've been doing a local market analysis, so we go out to each state park site, and we look within a certain radius, and we look at folks that do the same kind of stuff, so KOA Campgrounds is a good example. So we're very sensitive to the economic issues in the community. We know state parks are a big economic engine, but we don't want to cut the feet out from the local market, and so we try to be careful about that. We don't go out and sell our services a lot cheaper than the local KOA, because then we would be hurting the local entrepreneur. And likewise, we don't go out and set our fees too high because we want to drive everybody to the competition. So the bottom line is we try to bring balance to that. And we were asked to go back and relook at that, and we did. We've done some tweaking, but we will continue to do those annual analyses to try to be good neighbors for the folks who work in the communities. Rider 24 requires the state parks collect usage statistics. In other words, hours and mileage and uses on all major equipment and report the findings annually. One of the things that the new commissioners may not be aware of is we were experts at duct tape utilization over the last few years. A lot of our stuff was taped together and really was quite an embarrassment to us and to the states. And so one of the things that the legislature asked us to do is to start looking at how we use equipment, making every effort we can to use the new dollars to get rid of that old stuff and get the new equipment in the parks. But we are now tracking our usage of major equipment within the parks, and we'll be recording that utilization to the legislature on an annual basis. Rider 27 asked us to implement annual revenue projection procedures. We've worked with administrative resources. Obviously, it's been kind of the driver in this particular kind of rider. And submit a plan that establishes revenue goals for each park. We talked a little bit about this already. I'm not going to spend a lot of time there. We have transmitted, as required under this rider, our revenue enhancement plan to the Legislative Budget Board and to the Governor's Office. Once again, that plan is directed at trying to help us figure out new ways to generate revenue to support state parks. Rider 29 requires that we implement the recommendations of the SAO report, which, as I've reported, we have done. We will continue to do on time. It also requires to hire 16 internal auditors to be placed in the field primarily to help us audit these ongoing recommendations that we're implementing. That has been accomplished. Dennis O'Neill is the director of internal audit. 16 auditors have been employed, and they are in place in the field, and audits began this week at, I believe, 8 sites. I think I'm speaking correctly. So audits are underway. These are audits to make sure that these financial control policies and procedures that we have implemented are working. And so we will have a very aggressive process over the next year to make sure that what we've done works. We're working very closely with the Legislative Budget Board. I add that Ms. Tina Beck, our Legislative Budget Board analyst, is in the audience, and we appreciate the work she has done with us and helping us get this on the right track. So we will be aggressively auditing each of the parks as we go forward, making sure they're doing what we think they're doing.
Is that strictly fiscal audits, or are you doing operational audits? Is part of that, or walk me through that a little bit?
It's a full-blown audit. The primary focus will be on financial controls and financial mechanisms, but there will be management components to the audit
that way. When do you expect to kind of approve that back? I mean, how walk me through kind of first reports and second reports?
I believe that the audits will take a couple of weeks at each part.
Walk in on
Brent Leisure is a regional director of state parks who I have drafted to be one of the leaders of the state park audit response team, and he has been very intimately involved in the development of all these recommendations.
Is this appropriate time? Sorry,
yes, sir. Just
in my brain.
Brent knows the details of the
good.
A little bit. The audit, as Scott mentioned, began actually last week.
Can you give your name?
Yeah, Brent Leisure. I'm the regional director for Region 5 State Park. I'm currently assigned here in Austin to help coordinate our response to the state audit report. The audits that are taking place in parks are occurring in each region. As Scott said, and being some of you, our audit director his higher education office. Those audits take about a week to occur, and they take about an additional week to 2 weeks to further analyze the data that they've collected and go over the results and prepare a report. Those reports would go to management, and management would have an opportunity to respond to the findings of the audit. We are very hopeful. We're confident that the staff in the field are taking this very seriously. The training that's occurred has helped prepare us, I think, to be successful in the audit. The audit themselves is conducted by internal audit. Have to do with the financial processes of the department, business practices, some of the performance issues, and other things that I think you would quite typically find in a performance audit are more generally done by the regional director and regional staffs and park staffs themselves. Park superintendents have a very specific and defined role in leading compliance checks with fiscal controls for auditing those processes as well. So the internal auditors are specifically looking at fiscal control, but we do consider all the other performance areas in management.
There needs to be definitely integration.
Absolutely.
That part of what, you know, came out of this last round of the legislature is maybe the lack of integration in terms of performance relative to how we were measuring performance in the parks, of our park superintendents and others, and the fiscal control. I think that's what's tied together for them.
Exactly right. And, you know, we've integrated many of those, not just the financial controls, but the management aspects of performance in a park into the park managers and the regional directors' performance plan.
Okay.
So it's incorporated in that way as well.
I think it goes even beyond that, Mr. Chairman. I know when Mr. Cook and I first discussed how we were going to organize the response, one of the things we just decided right off is that it needed to be not executive staff in Austin before organizing the response. We needed to bring in the leadership from state parks and field. We needed to work with the leadership and administrative resources. So as you can tell, I mean, I think every regional director in there, for the new commissioners, there are 8 regions in state parks, 8 regional directors, great folks. Every one of those folks has been pulled into service here, as have many of the park managers and park superintendents. But this has been something that we understood the importance of pushing recognition and acceptance down into the culture, and thought the best way to do that is bring people from the field here to help us develop and come up with the solution. So I think we've been pretty successful there. I think if you go out into the parks and out into the field, you will hear folks saying this is important. This is something we have to do. I won't pretend that it's going to be easy on the state park staff right now. It's a manual process. It takes a lot of time and a lot of paperwork. And we have a plan to solve that, and I'll talk about that next.
Any questions? This might be a good time, and I would ask the commissioners as this goes on over this next year or so, and we head into January 09 on the legislative period, that we can all get up to speed on this, because this is certainly a major focus of the legislators, certainly the Senate Finance and the House, both sides. Well, there's going to be a lot of focus on the state audits and how we handle it, and most importantly, of course, how we implement them, what we learn from. And so I would ask all of you to get involved at whatever level you're comfortable with. We're going to need to have good knowledge, because at the end of the day, we're going to get a lot of questions on this starting January 09. I would start.
Mr. Chairman, when everything is said and done and you implement all these recommendations, what is the expected fiscal impact that you're anticipating?
In terms of increased revenues in state parks?
Yeah, that's a great amount.
Yeah, well, yes, sir, I guess I'll preface my answer by saying, first of all, we believe that from an operations perspective, there may be, and hopefully there will be, some increased revenue opportunities, particularly in areas, for example, where you have a hotel that's an Indian Mountain Lodge, Indian Lodge out in Fort Davis. If you fix up that hotel and you add rooms and make that thing more amenable to folks, it may generate significant more revenue. However, I will say that much of what we're going to do with money is maintain the system we've got. And so I think it's important to weigh that balance. A lot of the problem is that under the current or under the existing circumstances up until this year when we got this money, our restrooms were falling apart. We had ceilings that leaked. We had roofs that were falling in on people. screen shelters didn't have screens on them. So we do believe there will be some revenue impact, but it may not be as large as some folks would hope. I don't have the number on my
head. Mary, do you remember what we projected?
We have projected about a 3.5% increase in this fiscal year from the prior fiscal year. And some of that, I think, can be attributed to increased fiscal control. We've also improved some of the discounting processes and that sort of thing that I believe will bring in some additional revenue, but we don't have an exact dollar amount relating to that specifically yet.
I would be cautious to predict a number at this point. I really think it's important for us now to focus on spending this money wisely, making sure that we have a credible process to demonstrate how we're spending the money, making sure that the folks trust the fact that we are not wasting what we've got, and then we will see what the outcome of that is. So some folks would argue that we have increased revenues. Others would vote. Folks would argue this is going to help us maintain the revenues we've got rather than experiencing some drop-off.
Mr. Parker.
Mr. Chairman, I want all the commission to remember my friend Tony's question, because when we get into the infrastructure committee, for a full time,
good.
On answering that question.
Good.
And the problem does not lie with what starts on. So I'll say that.
We'll be awaiting.
With bated breath.
With bated breath, absolutely. And pocketbooks. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
One of the areas that I think were criticized was on the revenue side as far as who we were charging to go into actually into the parks and waiving certain fees to certain people.
Yeah.
How are we going to, in this new plan, how do we, and understanding that probably has to be some flexibility on the director of each park to allow the Boy Scouts or whoever to come in, but are we going to have set guidelines throughout the system to guide them in making those decisions?
Yes, sir. That's exactly what we did. And I think the problem was, and everybody concurred when we took a look at it, is that we gave too much discretion to the park managers. They were all over the place. The fact is, they need to have some discretion. There are groups, Boy Scout groups, and church groups, and school groups that come out that we need to be able to put down things for. But we need to be able to monitor and track them. I really believe the SAO's complaint, I'm talking SAO specifically, was not so much that we discount, it was that we couldn't track what we discounted and how we discounted. So we've come up with a model that gives each park and every park the same option. And that is, I believe it's three different options, discounted to 25%, 50%, or 100%. But the key piece of that is not just what they can do and that it's consistent across parks, it's the way they document it. So we have a very tight documentation system now, so that those discounts are well documented, come back in to us on a regular basis. We can compile the report so that the next time around, because that was part of the problem. When the legislature or the SAO said to us, how much are you discounting? We didn't really know. And that was the same on us. We need to know. So we will know in the future.
That consistency was a big issue.
Yes, sir. And documentation.
And then the follow-up documentation.
And I think as important as that question is, that obviously the end goal from this, but understanding our revenue base and understanding our expenses and our efficiency is maybe the first step, and then focusing on what we're trying to accomplish with it.
Brent, thank you. You like your support, right?
Yeah.
And I did want to give Brent, and Scott later, I'll give you credit, but I want to give Brent a lot of credit because he kind of stepped from one role into this role overnight, and he's really taken on a load. He's done a heck of a job. So I want to thank you for that.
Something I did not mention early on is that we also employ a person from outside the agency with 25 plus years of business management experience. Let me say, go from Mr. Stan Wheeler, who's not here today, probably should have invited him, to Stan and Brent and several other folks really I'm curious if Yeoman's way here in terms of putting these responses together or coordinating the actual verbiage that goes into these and talking with multiple divisions around this. So I appreciate all of it. Back to the report, we're almost through. I apologize for the length of the report. Next to the last rider, rider 30, requires us to submit a business plan for the State Park Capital Program. This is our infrastructure expenditure program. And Mr. Wisden is going to talk about it a little more later, as Mr. Carter referenced, which directs us to consider criteria like public needs, recreational values, cost estimates, health and safety, et cetera, some of the things we've already talked about here. It also directs us to submit the results of a private vendor study, which will determine project impacts on park revenue and visitation. We have done this. We have, first of all, already submitted our business plan for the construction of our repair facilities to the Legislative Budget Board. They are reviewing that as we speak. We were also directed to report any variances in capital projects that exceeded 10%. We have come up with a procedure that allows us to do that. We have that cost report ready to go. We will be on a periodic basis reporting the LEB and the governor's office on 10% variances of our capital projects. I might add the 10% variances, and I think Mr. Parker could verify this, are not unusual in the capital construction business, but it is something that's worth reporting, and we will do so as instructed. We have contracted with a private vendor to do a study on the impact of capital repairs. I think the intent of the legislature was to kind of find out the question that you asked, Commissioner. I'm going to ask this, is this going to result in any money? I think my answer is a little vague because I don't know the answer yet, but this is what the study's going to find out for us. They're going to look at the expenditures of capital program money and the associated impact on visitation revenue. Will it drive visitation revenue up? Will it not? Will it keep it the same? Those kind of questions will fall out of the study. The study is due, it should be out in the spring, around March.
Yes, one question I have for you on the private vendor study. Does that study include looking at capacity increases at all the parks where the terminal people are where they get overloaded?
I'm looking with
what we have
customers.
We make sure it does because there's something we can have parking bathrooms.
Yes, sir. Commissioner, I believe it does, and it also takes into account similar services offered in neighboring state parks. So we're offering a particular facility at one site, which is down the road. If we're offering that same facility, they're going to look at occupancy rates and determine whether or not we need the public need for satisfying that need. There's
some specific to make sure we look at additional capital improvements that have capacity in new park where we have over capacity returning.
Sure. With that contractor,
right?
Okay. The last rider at almost the end of the presentation is rider 31, and this is an interesting one. It calls us to conduct a study which creates a definition of a high quality state park system.
Yes, sir.
High quality state park system. We have combined this with the same vendor that's doing the previously discussed study, so that at the same time they're doing studies about capital improvements and how much that will impact visitation revenue, they're going to look at what the definition of a high-quality park is. Some of the interesting components of this particular rider is that we would like us to look at things that we might expect, like amenities and public demand and utilization, and those will be looked at. One of the things that asks us to do is look at which parts do not fit in the system and which parts should be transferred out of the system. So there will be some document that comes out of the exercise that targets specific parts that might not be appropriate in the state park system. The last slide I've got is to talk a little bit about our efforts to automate the financial controls and fiscal controls that I talked about earlier. A lot of those 20,000 hours and plus of labor that's gone into this project have been on the fiscal control side, because that was the issue that we did. We were the most vulnerable and it was the most important for us to correct, not just from a credibility issue, but from a business management perspective. So one of the things we did is we looked at all the recommendations. We went back and visited with the executive office staff, which is administrative resources staff, and the leadership of state parks. We decided what we needed was an automated way to do financial control. So what we have out there now is a manual system. You go to the park, you give somebody your money, there's going to be two people that look at that money. Somebody's going to have to do it once, and somebody's going to have to come behind and sign off on it. That's one of a multitude of manual system controls that have been put in place. And we're confident, standing alone, they will do the job. The only point is that's not very efficient. We're already trying to stretch it means bathrooms get cleaned less. It means you folks may expect a few more letters about folks that are unhappy with the conditions of the parks. So we're trying to minimize that. But clearly, that's not where we want to be years down the road. So we have, not at the direction of the legislature or not at the direction of SAO, decided to go out and obtain an automated system that would incorporate many of these financial controls and would link it to our reservation system. We already have a pretty quick reservation system. We call 1-800 number, you can get your reservation. Unfortunately, on the back end, there are not many financial controls linked to the system. And that was the genesis of many of the problems that we had. So we have gone out for an RFO, a request for offers from vendors to put forth an automated system. The closing was just this month. In fact, I said at a meeting a couple of weeks ago, we had a lot of vendors from around the country attend, talking about the parameters that we are interested in, the kinds of things we want to call out of the system. The vendors should be selected early in the year, around January, and we should have the system implemented. It's our goal to have the system implemented in the winter of the late prior to legislative session is going to be a tight schedule. I hope to have it implemented then. If not, we will have it implemented shortly thereafter.
Yes. Are there systems of this nature currently in use?
There are many systems around the country in use. None of them are very comprehensive. We were a little bit surprised. We did a nationwide survey of other state park systems. We talked to the National Park Service. We talked to some private organizations that do reservations and have huge fiscal impacts like hotel chains and those kinds of things. We were surprised to find that there was, at least that we could identify quickly, there was nothing off the shelf. And in fact, one of the things that happened, the Walters attended the National Park Conference, I came back to the Southeastern Conference, there's a lot of talk out there about the other states looking at this system. So there's a lot of incentives for vendors that are going to respond to put together a system that would be attractive to multiple states. A lot of states are in worse shape than we are in terms of their fiscal management. Other states have systems that have pieces of the system that we're interested in, but we could not find one that had a holistic approach that would do everything we wanted.
This level of fiscal control and management, we cannot find it at all.
Yeah.
And in these type of systems, if we do this and do it right, which we will do, it will be a pace setter for a lot of other folks because the need for it is there. Everybody's been hobbling, getting by, but it's timely, and I think we'll have a lot of interest from other states and from that system if we get the system. One thing I want to just regress just a little bit, Scott, and I think y'all will touch on it later. This private vendor business we contracted with for study of the physical impact of some of these capital equipment. In other words, if you go out there and improve your wastewater system, is that going to bring new revenue? Yes or no? If you fix the roof, is it going to bring new revenue? Yes or no? Some of it's very basic like that. But if you repair your RV hookups, if you upgrade your RV hookups, probably will. So that's the kind of thing that group is going to be looking at. It becomes really important, and you'll hear more about it here today, because some of our repair money is tied to the completion of this report. And you will hear more about that. So keep that report and that date in mind.
I guess my last comment is I wanted to make you aware that when we put this team together, it's a huge team, when I say team, it's in excess of 100 folks. we decided to go out and put together a cross-divisional effort to do this, and people were a little confused at first. Why would I put somebody from Iowa back on the scene? I'll tell you why. Infrastructure for other places. This is something we as an agency need to take seriously across the agency, not just in state parks. We don't want to repeat this in other divisions. And so I think it's been very helpful for us to have folks from other divisions in on the process and learn about the importance of fiscal management. Now, a lot of our folks who are not trained on that, I suspect that if you find some of the same results you take outside state parks in terms of the background. So bottom line is, I think it's been important for us to get across additional effort. We look forward to this continuing process and putting up these recommendations in place, and we'll be back answering questions.
I echo the chairman's comments on Mr. Leisure and his cohort. As the regional director, though, we've got a great group of regional directors that have long since put together a group team there. Our park managers themselves hunger for this. They are very supportive, and we've got a great team out there. I think you'll see the results of this very positive.
When we get this system in place, and if it is something that will be adaptable to other states, is there any way that we can benefit? Is there any way we can make it proprietary and make it
adaptable? I know, get royalties or something.
Well, we've had that conversation with Commissioner Zai, and I'm not a contracting expert. It's my belief that if we go out and have a third-party vendor do this, that that's probably not an option, but certainly something we can look into.
You know, if we're going to put all these hours on the next to the team that often,
and I agree, but however, the hours that I'm articulating in this particular presentation are not hours we put into developing the automated system. They're hours we put into responding to the recommendations of state auditor's rights. But it's certainly something we considered at one point. We considered whether it might be wise to build this system ourselves.
Right.
We've had the same discussions around our licensure system and those kind of things. And ultimately, at least in most cases so far, we've come to the conclusion that that's not the business we're in, and we're better off to hire somebody that knows what we're doing.
That sums it up, really. Go back to our automated licensing system. So, playing official licenses, I challenged our, we got the greatest IT folks in the world. I mean, they're super, super. But in order for us to build a system that we own, that we could market, the cost of implementing that system was, of course, significantly higher than Verizon or something like that, putting the system together. But and we're in a similar situation here. We're looking right now. We're talking to these folks and seeing what possibilities are.
But I'm glad Mark brought it up because, Scott, I think, you know, that's part of what you can work with when you work with a third-party vendor, because we are going to be doing a lot of work. I mean, we don't, and that's what there's real risk here. I mean, we well know. Okay, so you want to get it up and running by winter of 08, which I would agree is a fairly short time frame for these kinds of comprehensive systems. And then you want to get it up and it doesn't crash on you, and it works. And so there's some real risk here on our part, and because we have to share some of that risk, and I think, you know, as you're dealing with that third-party vendors, make sure they understand that, and it's their job, but maybe that's where we can get a discount, or we can certainly get help relative to getting the system. It is going to be us eventually making work on the ground. One other thing, like I said, I'd like to thank Scott. Scott has jumped in here with both feet. Maybe, you know, you'd say, well, that's his job and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, it trickles down attitude-wise, and Walt Dabney's been a big part of this too, but overall, Merrifield, everybody has taken the audit from a positive point of view instead of it being looked at as punishment or, you know, we're after you or that kind of thing. They've taken it and said, you know, this is the way we can improve this department, we can improve parks, we can improve the overall. I really appreciate you putting the across the groups of people in it so that everybody gets stronger in our fiscal controls. And so because of that, it's now looked at as a tool to improve this department. And because of that, I think we're getting the kind of response we're getting. So, Scott, I appreciate that. I think a lot of it started with you and the attitude you took. We could have gone the other way, and gotten angry or said, you know, they're trying to beat us up or whatever. And instead, we said, no, let's take this thing on with it. So,
I understand that our staff thinks we are going to be a better organization.
We will be. We will be a better organization. Any other questions or comments for Scott or Brent or anybody on this? So again, I certainly strongly recommend all our commissioners, you know, kind of keep up to speed on it. It's going to be moving fast. And it's going to be where we're going to get lots and lots of questions starting in right on that.
Is this included in the hard copy thing that you sent us out earlier? The first two reports, I believe, that come to you, and we will be sending you a hard copy each time we issue it.
Okay.
So we get a hard copy on this, this presentation and the email I'll see that you give.
We'll be at there, buddy.
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Any other questions or comments? Anything? Thank you, Brent. Committee item number four, Sunset Commission, review of Texas Parks and Wildlife, Mr. Gene McCarty, and Sunset. Another very important issue going on, right, Gene?
Very important.
Very important, absolutely.
This is Chairman, Commissioner, for the record, my name is Gene McCarty. I'm Deputy Executive Director for Administration. The item before you today is going to be a brief update on the sunset review process. First question, and what I'd like to do is give a little background on the essence of what sunset really is. And the first question is, what is sunset? And generally, it's considered to be a review of the mission of a state agency determined that the purpose for which the agency was created still exists, and that the agency is adequately addressing that purpose. Agencies are generally reviewed once every 12 years. Texas Parks and Wildlife in recent history hasn't been on a 12-year schedule at all. Texas Parks and Wildlife was last reviewed in 2001. The legislation associated with that review was Senate Bill 305, and we call it our Texas Parks and Wildlife Sunset Bill. A number of different things came out of that sunset bill in 2001. A land and water conservation recreation plan was directed by that legislation. Changes in how Texas Parks and Wildlife interacts with its nonprofit partners was included in that legislation. The way this committee of the commission functions was kind of codified and to some extent changed through that process. The reason y'all would take a vote here, it was identified as a concern. That there was an adequate public comment opportunity for the legislature before the commission to vote in the committee. So you don't take votes in the committee, you just get the information process. That was brought out for the sunset. And ban on tobacco advertising in any department-related material came out of that last sunset process. Sunset, while it's got a finite date, 2009, it's really a four-year process. We began the sunset process basically as soon as the legislature was over in May. The first part of that process is the submission of the self-evaluation report, which we did on August 24, 2007. That self-evaluation report is submitted to sunset staff. They read it, review it, start that report, and they get a pretty good feel of what the agency does, what its functions are, what its purpose is, what its mission is, and how it is currently carrying that function out. From that, those staff will begin to conduct field studies and evaluations. As you said, there's a staff. So why don't you walk through how it works with the House and Senate your points, and then there's a Sunset Commission in place. And
the Sunset Commission itself is made up of senators and representatives
and they are those members of the staff are of the commission are appointed by Speaker of the House and Lieutenant Governor. There is one public member appointed by the Lieutenant Governor and one public member appointed by the Speaker of the House. There will be five senators and five representatives. The chair of the Sunset Commission rotates in Senate House. This particular time, the chair is on the House side. So we will be looking now, go through the membership here in just a minute, start with the actual current membership of the commission as best we know it. Now, there is a Sunset agency, state agency, made up of, they have an executive director just as we do, and staff members. And those are the people who will actually be doing all of the field evaluation work and the actual review of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Last review session, we had four review specialists assigned to Parks and Wildlife. We don't know, at this particular point in time, we don't know how many we're going to have assigned and when and so forth. One of the reasons that we don't know kind of where we are right now in the Sunset process is that the Senate hasn't finished their appointments to the Sunset Commission. So the Sunset Commission has been unable to meet and approve a Sunset review schedule. And that's the field evaluation work will occur 2007 through 2008, but that schedule has to be approved by the Sunset Commission, which is not completed yet. There are a little over 20, I think there's 23 agencies up for Sunset review. That's going to force them to go into two review cycles. The first review cycle, they were hoping would have already started and would go through January or February. And the second review cycle would then start in January or February of 2008 and go through June or July of 2008. So they're already starting to get a little bit of a late start. We don't know what review schedule we're going to be in at this particular point in time, and we don't know who our review team is. But we will find that out very quickly once we get a full commission appointed. At the end of this evaluation report, you'll have evaluation period, you'll have a staff report that's prepared by Sunset staff. It will generally identify a number of issues within Parks and Wildlife that they would like to take forward to the commission for review and hopefully adoption. The last time we were in Sunset, we started in with the Sunset staff report with 12 issues. At the end of the Sunset Commission process, where the Sunset Commission actually reviewed the staff report, and they took public comments and sort of thing. We ended up with 14 issues. So staff brought up 12 issues. The public or the commission itself identified a couple of additional issues that they wanted to put on. The Sunset Commission meeting and basically the adoption of the staff report or the modification and then ultimately the creation of the Sunset Commission report will occur probably late 2008. Usually around September, October of 2008.
They got a lot of work to do.
Just so I understand, was our agency under total review in 2001?
Yes.
But they did not at that point in time vote to extend it for 12 years?
Yes, sir, they did.
They did? Okay.
And when we went through the Sunset Review last time, it started in 1999. Our Sunset legislation was adopted in 2001.
Okay.
That extended the agency to exist until 2013.
Okay.
That was codified in Senate Bill 305.
Okay.
Now that can change at any time. Every time the legislature meets, that date, can be changed, and that's what happened. That date was changed by legislative process. My legislation, that date was changed from 2013 back to 2009.
Okay.
Yes.
How does the prior
When was the last one prior to 1985.
We went through a fairly long period of time there. There's a couple of reasons. There's a couple of reasons for that. We're really, they make sense. We, at the time we were going to be up for some of the review again, all of the environmental agencies in the state were kind of being somewhat up for review. That's when they did a lot of consolidation of these. They have probably six or eight different environmental agencies that they ended up consolidating into what became TCDE finally, ultimately. So they postponed it a few years to get us back on track so that all of the basic resource and environmental agencies were on the same review cycle. Now we're all cycled again, but you know that's a different issue. From the Sunset Commission report, they will begin to draft legislation. Legislation will be drafted by one of the members of the Sunset Commission. They will be assigned. Part of the responsibility of being on the Sunset Commission is you will carry legislation to either abolish or maintain the agencies under review. So a legislator, a House member will either take the lead. In this particular case, probably a House member will take the lead. But a Senate, there will be a Senate sponsor, and that Senate sponsor will also be a member of the commission. They will draft legislation. The legislation should specifically revolve around the recommendations that are identified in the commission report. And then we go through the legislative process. That legislation is carried through the process. Hopefully, it continues the agency and is adopted before the end of the legislation. Then we go into the implementation. It's a four-year process. It's not just the review. Then you have to go in and implement what changes they make. So you have about a year to do your implementation. In this case, you'll be in another implementation from 2009 to 2010. This sunset comes back and does what's called implementation compliance review. And they will carry out that compliance review between 2010 and 2011. And just prior to the 2011 legislative session, they will prepare a compliance report. If you're not in compliance with the recommendations, they have the option to push back in sunset to start all over. Sunset Commission, as it exists right now, the House has made its appointment. Representative Carl Isaac from Lubbock will be the chair. Lois Culpers from Brenham is a member. Ruth Jones McClendon from San Antonio. Dan Flynn from Canton. And Linda Harper Brown from Irving are your House members. Your public member from the House is Ike Sugg from San Antonio, for San Angelo. If you are appointed to Sunset, you serve for two terms, two 4 years basically, two legislative cycles. So you have some holdovers. So your Senate holdovers are Senator Kim Reimer from Fort Worth, Senator Robert Gould from Greenville, and Senator Trey Estes from Wichita Falls. You have two vacancies that we're waiting on appointments from the Lieutenant Governor, and you have a vacancy in the public members. Of your House members, Lois Culpers, Ruth McClendon, and Dan Flynn are your holdovers from your previous session. Any questions? Kind of briefly where we are in the sunset process today, we'll be waiting. Basically, we're waiting on Senate appointments. And then we're waiting on the Sunset Commission meeting that will designate for us when we will begin the review process with new evaluation who our review staff will be.
So you were last reviewed in 2001, but you called it a 4-year process.
We completed our compliance report in 2003.
Okay.
Just prior to 2003 legislation. Got a 99.9% of one item that we had not completed. And the reason we had not completed was those items that took months to complete.
Right.
We had not completed it. And that was an acceptable reason for not completing it. I think it was specifically an item that said we were to implement all of the recommendations of the Joint Committee on Texas Parks and Wildlife State Parks and Historic Sites, and to fully have implemented that was going to cost us about $24 million in capital construction dollars that we just did not have.
Okay, but I wanted the other commissioners to know that we've gone through the compliance cycle in the last round, and it was very acceptable. You said 99.9%.
Okay. What are they looking to have those vacancies filled?
Any minute now. Sharon Isaac is very anxious. I spent some time with him this last week. He's very anxious to get his counterparts appointed and even on the government.
Although it's a tremendous amount of work, I will tell you that Sunset Review, although it's ahead of schedule, and as I said, it's a tremendous amount of work, it is a real opportunity. I think any time you go through a session and come out of it with additional funding that we came out of this last session with, you can anticipate a lot of close review and watch from us, and that's fine. We're in good shape. You know, I've encouraged staff, and we've had a couple of pretty good brainstorming sessions on this, to use this as an opportunity to look for areas that we need to grow in, areas that we need to change, improve in, whatever that expands. There's some real opportunity here for us to identify communities that we see in our systems, whether that be in our hatcheries, whether that be in freshwater, saltwater, state parks, public hunting, whatever it might be, that we see, that we hear, that we believe that we want to hear from the public as to something, you know, so having trails, those kinds of initiatives, it's an opportunity to identify those, bring those out, get the legislature to think through some of that process and say, no, we support that, or no, we don't want you guys going. So we're taking that kind of approach with the Sunset Process. That group of people in general are very supportive of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and the things that we do. And they will try to help us and work with us, and we intend to go ahead at full speed.
Gene, did they also look at all of our advisory committees and evaluate them, or is it just the agency as a whole? I mean, how
they do evaluate your advisory committees, whether or not you have statutory authority to have them, and whether or not they don't really get into whether or not they're actually functioning. They do that, you know, basically.
Who was the chair on the Senate side last time?
Kim Brown. He'll stay on another round, but not as chairman.
We don't know whether he'll be vice chair or what the
who is vice chair right now?
Los Culpers.
We have a bunch of past chairs on there, or vice chairs.
Yes, now. I'm sorry. I misspoke. It was true.
For them to stay on four, they have to get reelected, at least from the House side. Any other questions or comments on the Sunset? Again, another place I'd ask all the commissioners to stay involved. Don't hesitate to call Gene or Bob or Scott, because again, this is across the full department. But as Bob talked about, I think it's a plus and a minus, and comes allows us to go out as part of the process of going out to public hearing, begins with. They go also to all the advocacy groups, the general interest groups, the civic interest groups also, and ask them for their input. And so it's a good way to get a lot of focus and input, as you expect, some of it doesn't quite make sense, but a lot of it does, and it's very helpful for us to kind of test the pulse of the state and what our constituents want us to do. So, and Gene, I appreciate you jumping in with both teams as usual. It's going to take a lot of your time, I know that, but Gene's been through it before, and because of that, and I feel confident that we'll do well. Thank you. Committee item number five, license fee increases. Mr. Larry McKinney, lucky guy, you get to do this, huh?
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, sir. I just wanted to ask about this yesterday. And I said, if those who were willing to give it a try, it was the obvious choice. I was the closest to retirement.
We'll try not to beat you up.
For the record, my name is Scott Boris, Deputy Executive Director of Operations. I just wanted to preface the presentation. We appreciate Larry doing this. He helped us lead this effort the last time around. We thought it was a logical choice to take up the banner again. And really, the genesis of this thought process was to fill the commission in on a looming reality, which is, you know, over the next 4 or 5 years, particularly in Fund 9, if we don't look at some fee increases, we may be looking at some revenue issues that we would not be positive for the agency. I don't say much more than that. I think Dr. McKinney is into the details, so I appreciate Dr. McKinney leading this effort for us.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries for the record. And I do appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, Scott. I think it frames it up pretty well. I struggled a bit with how to introduce this whole topic. And as I said, I think this will be one of the most important issues that you all deal with, the issue that we're trying to address, that you'll deal with in your tenure, so it's a very, very serious one, and an important one, too, in that as we move forward, as Scott talked earlier this morning, the situation that has occurred in Park, we really put some Park Division to the other side of the house, and we're talking about now the Fund 9 side, which is law enforcement, wildlife, coastal fisheries, and inland fisheries. The situations that the parks have faced over the years, we've been facing the same ones in the Fund 9 side. Now, it hasn't been quite as visible. We don't have bathrooms we have to clean. We don't have battleships and trains and things we have to deal with, unfortunately. But we've been dealing with those issues. Now, a couple of differences have been we've had a little bit of a buffer to help us deal with it. We'll talk about that. But also, we do have some time, a little bit of time for us to address the issue, so we don't reach that stage where we have to make you all, and we all have to make great enough decisions in the future. We have the opportunity to not do that. Clearly, that's where we want to go. And my first job really is to set a framework, a context in which we're going to talk about this issue, so I'm going to try to do that for you. And the first point I really want to make is that our constituents have really got the money's worth from what we've done over the years. And that's not just our own system, but that is the outside folks. I'm trying to put some of this together for you here just to give you an idea of what is set on. For example, 71% of our constituents are satisfied with what we do. Over 87% feel that the fish and wildlife resources are being well managed. These surveys done by Dr. Duda, who works around the country on these types of things, when he talks to him about it, as you said there, he's never really seen numbers like that for an agency of our size. It's pretty incredible that you have 75, even up close to 90% of people satisfied with what you're doing and the resources you're managing. Our programs are also very effective. You take a look at just hunter education, voter education, since they've been put into place, the reduction in accidents and incidents that we've had, which I think is indicative of the job that they do. We've been able to increase, even during this time, our number of gateways from 376 in 2004 up to 516 today with the new class there as well. We've certainly built our relationship with private landowners, which is the core of our wildlife management efforts in the state. And we've constantly added new partners, private land partners, and now help them manage over 20 million acres of land, which is
congratulations.
Mike Berger and staff have really, really moved on that part, and obviously the results are coming forward. This has not been something that's happened in the last few years. We've had a good relationship with our constituents over the years. For example, our anger satisfaction data for many years has been consistent and positive. We certainly put a lot of effort into bringing new constituents in. This gives you an idea from 2007, the number of youth and adults that we worked with to bring them into fishing. And then on the other hand, something that Commissioner Montgomery certainly has been involved in, we talked about our science review, trying to make sure our science is the best possible. I had the opportunity about 2 weeks ago to go out to California and give a talk to the National Home Academy of Sciences, and President Academy and other members were there. The whole issue is how to make science better, more important than making policy decisions around the country. And they were frankly just stunned with what we have done here. And when I talk to other sister agencies, that this just doesn't happen in other places. People don't put themselves up for unsaid review, maybe what it is on science. Like we have to make sure and they're very interested in the models. Well, this model will be duplicated around the country, so it's done.
Well, I knew the question issue. We got through just a little bit out of that. You brought in National Review.
Well, and I want to give the credit to Mr. Cook. This was one of his ideas. I think this is one that will one of his legacies that will last, which I appreciate. And that is that clearly you have and the legislature has as many difficult decisions to make. You want to make sure you have the best information available, and if you have confidence in that information. Well, probably the best way to do it, starting from the science side of that, is to have independent reviews of what we do, peer reviews, basic scientific tools. And so what we were able to do was to bring in the American Fisheries Society and the Wildlife Institute and the National Academy of Science to take a look at our program, sit down, look through them, and tell us what they thought was good about them and bad about them, and how we can improve it. And we've done that. And clearly that's the process we want to continue on a regular basis. Make sure that you all can continue to have confidence in that science.
I give all you credit. Bob definitely credited the leader, but also Larry, you and others willing to do that, because there's just not many agencies around the country that have ever done that. Much less done it openly and inviting people. So I give you all a lot of credit. It's really great credibility level from that.
And
that's
our intent.
Absolutely.
It has made a difference, all these types of things. As we look at surveys around the country, Texas is the number one hunting state with over 1 million participants. We're the number two fishing state, although I put that with a caveat. Florida beats us out, but only because they have so much coastline and have so many visitors. If you just look at resident anglers, we have more resident anglers in our state than Florida, by over 21%. So we can call ourselves number one in fishing for the whole state. And number three in wildlife working. We have a lot of participants. Now, those activities have translated into tremendous economic benefits for the state of Texas. Over $4.7 billion from fishing, $4.6 billion from hunting, and $5.7 billion for wildlife viewing. It's real dollars to the economic benefit of our state. The challenge, of course, is trying to maintain that in the face of a lot of things going on. Of course, the 800-pound gorilla here is the fact that the population of the state of Texas is doubling and will double by 2030. We'll have almost 40 million Texans. I talk about this a lot, and when I talk to out-of-state archers, I think what's going to be, we have twice as many of us as we do right now, twice as many Texans as we do right now, but the issue is trying to deal with that impact. And it's just not going to be enough for us to set bag limits and seasons and those types of things anymore. That went out the window a long time ago. In fact, we have to be in a position to influence those factors that really now affect those wildlife resources. Things like invasive species, we've always had that's a growing problem. The white vegetation we've been dealing with for a long time. But we have new things like exotic and Australian jellyfish coming in, and those types of things we have to deal with. We have new technology. Wind farms that we have to take a look at, liquefied natural gas plants, and those are special. Those are the types of things we're there with. And of course, the ongoing issue of water, and that's one that has been with us and will be with us, and clearly the key resource issue that Mr. Cook has emphasized over and over. And as we talk to our sister agencies around the country, and Mr. Cook was talking about this the other day, that the fact that many of these agencies are now realizing that they need to be involved in these water issues, water quality and water quantity issues, as we have been. And for some of them, it's too late. For others, it's not. And they need to get involved. But they're recognizing that a lot of what we can do and get done today in protecting fish and wildlife and meeting our responsibilities, we have to be able to influence other actions beyond those which we directly manage and regulate. That's just not enough. So these issues are time, resources, and money.
Kenny, on the wind farm, I know we've been involved somewhat in what's going on there, but Who ultimately makes the decision? TEC?
TEC or federal agencies? Or
basically, but there's more than environmental impact to Huawei's and various other things.
That has been the primary thing, is looking at that scientific information, studies and information, and making those concerns aware. And being represented on various bodies that are advising the regulatory agency. We didn't create that.
Mr. Brown, just a quick point there. It is based on science. I mean, our input has got to be based on science. And in an area that is not real good science.
Right.
And a lot of new areas, looking at wind farms, and whether you're talking water or these invasive species like very different, that, again, the key from, I think, our agency standpoint is to stand on good science. I think it's worth pointing out that the wind issue is becoming such a big issue nationally that Mr. Kempthorne has recently appointed a committee to look at sort of the, I don't know how to say exactly, to the placement of wind farms, the how they're built, what that machine looks like itself. And one of our employees in the Wildlife Division was appointed to that committee to represent. And Wildlife Bob's. And so we, again, are very involved in those processes nationally and the state involved.
I'd like to say thank somebody who's sitting right there. The Texas Wildlife Association initiated a very informative wind and wildlife seminar in Heavily last week, which I attended and brought up a lot of the issues that Parks and Wildlife is really going to have to get their hands around. This whole unbelievable growth of this industry, because the permitting is really not there. And we're going to have to get involved on various levels, but endangered species are environment.
We find ourselves there regularly, and this presentation, Doc's point here, and our point for having this discussion with you folks is getting involved in those areas. It requires research, requires time, requires folks to get in there on the ground and do some work, or to help fund the research through the universities or appropriate groups. And you look at that picture right there, and I see the LNG ship, and I think about a little episode we had it's kind of an ongoing episode, actually.
Yeah.
A particular one we had about a year ago. And what is the impact of warming that material out in the Gulf? What's the impact on the fisheries? And, folks, it's hard to find a day on which to base your recommendation. And the companies are responsive. They're working with us, and they've got to continue to work with us. Again, this brings us back to why we're having this presentation.
Okay. And just one more thing. And, Mark, I certainly understand what you're talking about. I think we've got to be real careful as an agency that, going back to what Bob said, well, the way we get involved is through science. Because certainly you've probably received calls, and a lot of commissioners probably have, trying to, for lack of a better term, pulling us in from a political point of view, or come up with a reason to or not to do these things. And the way I just referred that back to the science side of it. And to be blunt with you, on the wind farm, there's not a lot of science. There's not a lot. There's not at the national level or the local level. We haven't done much. But my guess is because it's going on, as you said, not only in the state, but nationwide, you're going to see more and more of it coming. And we may get asked by our legislature to do that eventually. That's right. We'll be glad to do it.
Based on science.
I think, Commissioner, a good example here to look at is water. We have no regulatory authority in most of these water decisions. And yet, every time the issue comes up, we look to and ask, what does your science say about this? If we take this much water, what happens? If what's the impact in the bay? What's the impact in the river? Mr. Grosher and Mr. McKinney's staff, Dr. McKinney's staff right now are studying those kinds of issues. What's the impact if? And to the springs, to the bays, and
reports. Back to you, Bob.
Good segue. And basically, the fact that doing all of this, and we have to do this, has certainly stresses out in the same situation we talked about in March. We have we've had to make some decisions within the money we've had and how we allocate. We've had to defer capital projects, purchase of vehicles, those types of things, that type of thing. Also, as we've gone through, our salaries have become less and less competitive. I know all of us have to deal with this type of thing. For example, in the last year, I've lost several of some of my best and brightest to other agencies, which means I can lose them to brightest, but sometimes we can't compete with mine. I'm not sure I hate to lose them to other agencies. That hurts. I don't want to be a training ground for other agencies either way, but these are issues that we're going to have to address, and of course, we need resources to do so. That's really where I want to focus now. And I begin to get into really dangerous ground here, moving from the science side to the budget side. But they figured if I could understand it and explain it, maybe I could get it across a little better than the order. Thank God I've got Mary behind me. Mary Seth and Julie Horsley and others who are and Gene, who really spent a lot of time on this. They kind of put this together for me to walk me through it, which I appreciate all three of them in particular doing so. Let's talk about it. This is, as I said, fund line. This is the side of the agency, the other side of the park. This is wildlife, law enforcement, coastal, and the fisheries. This is how we're funding our budget. And this is an example, or this shows you our fund balance. We do have a balance above the line that we available to us. And this is what it was in 07. And I want to give a little bit of detail on it, but one point I want to make first is that has created some issues with us with the legislature, but of course the legislature looks at, they're dealing with billions of dollars, they're looking at a very high level, and when they come and put the Parks and Wildlife in our agencies, and we talk about having to deal with the pay increases and operational increases, they look at this fund balance and say, well, you've got $73 million there, they can deal with these types of issues, it's there. It's not often clear that there's a lot of restrictions on these funds, and that's what I want to pair with you a little bit now. Now, a significant part of this fund in 2007, almost $40 million, would be available for our basic operations of salaries and gasoline and those types of things. That's the part of the fund that would be available if appropriated by the legislature. Another significant part of the funds are in restricted accounts, spam accounts. They are set aside for specific purposes, buying back shrimp licenses, building a fish hatchery, acquiring high wing dovelings or other things. They're very restricted what they can be used for. They're not available for general use, but restricted type use. Then there's another smaller fund that's also a restricted account. This is a situation where, for example, we might sell land, and those lands, that money has to be used for purchase of additional land. A big part of that is our artificial reefs. These are monies donated by oil and petroleum companies, and they are absolutely restricted to going back in to monitor and to manage those artificial reefs. They can only be used that type of thing. So these are the types of restrictions and basically what our fund balances look like. So before we start talking about the future of balances, one of the questions is, well, how do we generate that balance? And basically what happened was when we went through a fund increase in 2004, we worked with the legislature in coming out and adopting that the increase with the understanding that those funds would be made available to us through the legislative process to carry out the programs and so forth that our constituents were expecting us to do when they agreed and supported those fund increases. Well, the economic situations were not that good in the following session. There were certainly some changes in the legislature and across the board, agencies were getting budget cuts, as a matter of fact, because they're general fund agencies, so that was despite the fact that our constituents had stepped up to the plate and bought those licenses and generated those funds, we cannot access them. In fact, our budgets were cut during that period along with everyone else. So our actual operating expenses went down, but these balances began to generate. And so that's what we were left in 2007. When you take a look at our estimated fund balances starting 2007 going out to 2011, you get an idea of what our concerns are. The red bars there represent those funds, the general fund line, monies that are available for our salaries and operating type costs. The stamp funds, of course, are restricted, as are the blue ones and as are the green. So as we move forward, our balances, available balances to do basic operations will frankly, quite rapidly diminishes. So 2011, we won't have those balances. In fact, we'll be a little bit negative.
What were the major assumptions that are driving the revenue?
I'm going to leave that right in. That's where I'm going. Thank you for the heads up. That's what I'm doing. That's what's happening. That's up. One of the things that did help us begin to address address some of our issues was Rider 27, which basically said or allowed that the agency could expend funds over the comptroller's estimate. Each session, the comptroller makes an estimate of the revenues coming in, that's the basis of the appropriations, and we go forward with that. But this rider allowed us to basically say if we generate money above that estimate, that we can expend it on operating costs. So that's what did happen. We had, over the last few years, we did acquire $14 million. Those incremental monies are being added after 2007 and on to deal with that. But the big driver has been this, is the salary increase. And our salaries in the department are in two sources. We have an A and B classification group, which is most employed. Then we have a C classification, which is law enforcement and game work. And the C group got some significant pay raises. Well deserved. Appreciate that. And we also got other salary increases for the BNP group. And those accumulate. As you add them in every year, they grow. And that's what's shown there. So between those two, Commissioner Mayor, if that's what you're talking about, that's what's going to hit those funds. We'll have to use more and more of those available funds in order to meet those legislative requirements.
Correct me if I'm wrong. The basic assumption here is maintaining what we have.
Exactly.
There's no particular increase in staff or we see fuel increasing, we see cost of materials increasing, and to pretty much maintain what we have and conduct the work that we're currently doing and spend those dollars down.
Exactly.
And the salary increase assumption.
Salary increases are there and increase all current salary.
Are you talking about that question? Some number of this projected inflation number increasing salaries, or what's the guidance for the salary increase?
For the salary increase? Well, those are legislative mandates.
Those are there,
they've been approved, right. So we're adding them into the
system. It does not contemplate future salary increases.
And some FTE.
Correct. We're assuming flat FTEs and flat salaries for this debt.
We have no AR. What we are operating on is a budget of what we have today. The budget you approve in August is what we would assume for the future. No changes. I don't know. It's trying to hold ground, which
is a very conservative model.
Very much, I think it's actually going to be more quick than this, but that's. We want to be conservative, so that's what it is.
But just on the compensation standpoint, and arriving at these numbers, if we're losing a lot of good people to other agencies, don't we really need to know what are these other agencies paying? And at least have our budget at that level that we can remain.
We actually do know that. And Scott can look at this very carefully, which we appreciate. I think we're going to lower quattro.
Well, the reality is that many of our positions we've looked at the relative salaries across agencies. Our agency happens to, on general, pay in the bottom quartile of the classification range. Each position is classified a certain way and has a range of salary that is available within that classification. Our salaries tend to fall in that bottom quartile of the bottom one quarter of that range. We have for many years under Mr. Cook's leadership been trying to force that phenomenon up into the middle of the range, more than average within the range. However, every time we do that, of course, without new funding and new appropriations from the legislature, it means something else has to give. So we have made some progress. I don't think we're happy with where we are yet, but it's a balancing act. You have to be careful as you raise the salaries because you impact existing services. And in many cases, your only option is to get rid of employees in order to give other employees a raise. And so that's something that's a difficult management issue. It's something that we're very keyed in on, particularly this year with Mr. McCarty's help. The division directors and McCarty and I have been trying to address that as we can move forward, but it has been an issue.
It's particularly a sensitive issue where you're dealing with dedicated funds in fund nine divisions and Fund 64 Division. Just take any classified position you want to talk about, whether that's administrative assistant, technician, you know, something that you got them over here and you got them over here. Division directors, let's just say. If you raise a division director because you've got a little money in Fund 9, you raise those division directors up, and your division directors are sitting over there in Fund 64 going, I think, but it's just a fact. That's what we've been dealing with. So in order, like Scott says, in order to raise those salaries, if we give a 5 or 10% salary increase with a flat budget or a declining budget, that means FTEs are gone. That means instead of having 10 people in that park, you got 8. That's what we've been working on. These numbers, these estimates that you're looking at here, do not incorporate any additional salary increase. This is if we just hold where we are without a fee increase and without additional revenues of some kind, that's what's going to happen.
Are we going to have to look at it at some point to be competitive with other leases?
Absolutely. Mr. Bingham, staff is already looking at that. We basically know what the numbers are from the state agency standpoint, from federal comparable agencies, whether they're federal or state. We look at some of the private sector, but it's very, very difficult. Agency-wise, yes, we need this thing. This is something we've looked at very closely, and we're ready to move on it. We just need to build the foundation for it.
I think as we move forward in the discussion, that's some direction we're looking from the commission is what we're presenting you here. We're trying to tell you the assumptions we've made. We have not assumed under the model that Dr. McKinney is presenting here today that we're going to drive equity up to where we want it to be in terms of salaries across the agency. We're assuming a static model. Obviously, if the commission so desired, as we go forward in the discussion about license increases, we could drive a model to try to address some of those equity concerns. That's the conditions we're on.
It would be really good to do that sensitivity analysis and just see how that comes out, what the impact of that is.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Are we seeing here something that happened 10, 12 years ago in our state parks? Are we seeing something here that we need to really address now and correct it and not let it
get to the situation?
Get an affirmation there so that the ball doesn't get bigger?
Yes, of course. That's why we're starting to talk about this now. And there are other issues too. I don't know if Scott and Dr. McKinney are going to talk about it, but I mean, of course, we're focusing here on talking about potentially increased fees on hunting license, fishing license, and those kinds of things. But another thing we have to start talking about, and this ties into the sporting goods tax, for example, or other ways that we can start bringing funds in from people that are using our facilities, using the natural resources of the state of Texas. And I'm talking about, for example, ecotourism. And we've been talking about, and Scott and the group have already started the Audubon Society, canoers, kayakers, those kinds of people who are using these facilities and at this point really aren't putting any money into the helping the agency in this conservation, in the state of Texas conservation needs. So, yes, I guess to answer your question a little long-windedly, we've got multiple ways to approach it, and the key is we have to start today. So that we don't get in a situation on the wildlife side and the conservation side that happened to the park side. So this is a start, but we can't keep burdening it at any higher level, probably except for what I call natural increases, the hunters and fishermen. And so we're going to have to expand our constituency that helps us in our conservation needs going forward. So long-winded answer, but absolutely yes.
That's an excellent segue to the remainder of the presentation, and really that's the goal of this exercise for us to present at this time is to develop and implement a series of strategies that'll help us maintain the successes that we've achieved and really enhance our ability to deliver others. Now, there's a whole series of these strategies. The fee increase is just one of them, and I'm going to read for you. There'll be a series of presentations at this commission meeting and the next, and others to talk about this. So my objective today is to present that framework, so I'll talk about that. We'll talk for a minute about fee increases, just to give you some background. This is the first of the slides, just to give you an idea, a summary of the number of licenses we sell, how they break up between the different users, and the revenues that they generate over the last 2 years. That gives you, that's the upper right and lower left slide there. And then, as Mr. Cook referred to this morning, kind of a status of ourselves, which is actually quite good. When you look at the differences between 2007 and 2006, last year overall we were up 1.8%. And revenue 2.8, and this year so far we're up almost 5%. So that it's excellent. Our constituents are there and they're supporting us, and we appreciate that. So that's part of it. I want to give you a little background on the license fee increases in the past. We have data back from 1988. This gives you the graph here, the yellow line going across is the volume, the number of licenses sold. The red is the revenue generated, and I pulled out of that yellow line down the bottom. Super combo, we'll talk about that in a second. Those are numbers that are not in addition to these others, just because they're particular interest to put them in there to show you. Talk about fee increases. I picked just two licenses. Of course, we have many licenses that we deal with. I picked two licenses, the basic hunting and basic fishing license, and track through this period of time just so you get an idea of actual changes in fee increases. We had our first increase there in 1992 of about 30% where licenses went up. Another one in 98, 32% increase there. Then about in 2004 license a year, about 17% off the basic license today, where the hunting license is 23, the freshwater fishing license is the same, saltwater is a little more expensive. That just gives you an idea of the fee increases through that period of time. When you look at the super combo, which began back in the late 90s, you can see the changes there as well, from 49 to 59 to 64. A couple of little interesting points on there. One, as you see that blip right there, that our numbers have steadily declining. That's gone along the national track, but we had that pretty significant 70% decline over that period of time there. And really, as I tried to analyze that, talking with Jim McCarty and others, and they had that in a sentiment else, it looked like it's really, I think it's on track. But when we put that super combo into place, we had people who were buying a hunting license and a fishing license. Mm-hmm. Also, now they're buying a gun license. Okay, so we cut the licenses in half. Well, that 17% is about 150,000 licenses. And that first couple of years of combo, we sold 250,000. So that's probably about right. That's what happened. That's the time it suddenly jumped, but then it went to go steady. You know, so that's I'm satisfied with that. That's my story. We have some other indications of impacts. You know, one of the concerns or issues that you want to deal with in license is what is the resource, what resource impact you have. And clearly, that period there, that downtick, we had a drought condition going on around the state, and then we had a hurricane on top of that. So that was a little bit downtick that we saw. I think we're going to be able to see over the next year the opposite situation. We're going to see what the impact of a situation which is the best hunting and fishing situation in Texas that I have ever seen in my life. I mean, the condition, the habitat is just in wonderful condition. Our reservoirs are primarily in full, and we had great water last year. Now, the coastal region was down a little bit because of the fresh water, but I'm talking to my guys now, and they say it's on fire right now. The tides have come back in the spring, so you're not going to have more. We've never seen conditions like this, so we'll see the impact of absolutely great resource on life themselves.
So that law meetings outdoors now.
Well, we should. I tell you, it's going to be good. Yeah, I think it's going to be good. Let's take a look very quickly at the non-resident hunting and fishing license sales. Just in contrast, I'll run through the fee increases with them very quickly. A couple of times we have fee increases for fishing. We finally hit a 20% increase there in 97 for hunting. And then again in 04. My conclusion from this, I can't draw any conclusion. I don't think that our non-resident hunting and fishing has anything to do with our license sales at all. Let me something else altogether, be it economics or whatever, but you can see the changes in that. And so that we're trying to take a look at that. We do have some tools now to do analysis that we haven't had in the past. But clearly, it's there's something driving it up and down the economics.
If oil goes to $100 a barrel, I predict that it will continue on that.
So basically, what we'll be coming back to you in January with some options for our office to take a look at. And our goal, and the guidance that Scott said we'll need from you is what are we trying to do? We need to define our goals. Or are we just trying to maintain what we have? Or do we want to try to address some of those issues and expand the program that we've been asked to address? How do we want to deal with it? It's going to take money to do either one, but obviously we need to define the goals of what we're trying to accomplish. As we go and talk to our constituents, we want them to support the increases and other things. We have to be real clear on what we're trying to accomplish, and that'll be key for us to do. We talked a little bit about trying to understand the factors that affect the fee increases and others, and of course, how do we finish a fee increase proposal in consideration for you all in with other strategies we're going to talk about in a moment. We do have some, we're very fortunate, we have a number of tools of individuals and staff that we have not had before. We really understand these types of issues, so we're going to be able to provide you with some good information and analysis.
Can I ask you a question? Have you set, and I'm sure you've done this, have you sat down and listed every item that we offer and the price that we offer that item for? And then have you moved over on the right-hand side of the page and listed every item, service that we offer and do not charge?
No, I haven't done that right-hand exercise. That would be a lot of work to understand pretty soon. We might have that. I don't want to talk a little bit about that now.
Well, it might be a lot of work, but I would like to see posted up here those items that we offer free of charge. And if any one of them is significant and affect a great number of people utilizing a product that we are selling, that we are giving away, then I think we need to do it.
Well, I'm going to give you some examples.
Good.
And we can do more. In fact, we'll do that right now. That's one of the other strategies of developing new funding sources. I'll just pick two examples. One is Adam Trails, and the other deals with artificial reach. And this is something that we've been having trials about. We've had briefings on this, and we've developed and working on it for a number of years. It's very popular. In fact, we have far more demand right now for exception paddling trails than we can meet. And between Mr. Grosher and Lydia Savani and Tom Reed, we put a lot of resources into trying to develop those things. But frankly, we can't meet the demand. And if we want to expand that program, that means we're going to have to take it from other important areas as well, and we just can't do that right now. So that's an area where I've got many arrows in my back. Mr. Cook has a few too. Mr. Cook has several times raised the issue of we should have something. And there's a small but vocal group there that frankly don't, and I guarantee you, because this is on the agenda today, you're going to get some calls about it. But it's an important issue, and we've long provided lots of support for them, be it water, for the rivers, our game wardens to rescue them when they get lost. But now we certainly have concrete items. So this is an area that I still think we ought to be looking at, and I think perhaps we have more support certainly now, or most folks are beginning to realize what we are providing for them, and so I think is the basis for going forward on that.
Also, just to say something quickly, it's an area where we can really leverage public and private partnerships.
Absolutely.
We're going to need to get the money to something.
Exactly. There's a real opportunity to expand the access to folks that they've never had before. And it also makes fiscal resources available, which is pretty neat. On the other hand, artificial reef, we're about, hopefully, in a few days, about to sink probably the largest, most diver accessible artificial reef ever done in the Gulf of Mexico, probably in the United States. And that Texas Clipper will be an incredible economic boom for South Texas, and we're going to be doing studies on that, what that is. And fishermen will benefit from it too, and they've kicked in some money. But the reality is that this will attract a lot of divers to all of our fisheries. And this is a group who comes and says, look, we'd like to help, we'd like to pay more, they're like, okay, but we just don't know how. It's just figuring out a way to do it. And so that's, there are those groups that say, this is just figuring out a reasonable way to do this, and we're ready to go. So there are sources like that that we want to look at. And of course, the 800-pound drill out there, and Chairman, you've referred to that, that's those 4 million wildlife watchers that benefit from all the work that we do, and how can we have to get them involved and help us support this conservation, which is the basis of what they're enjoying. We need to figure out an equitable way to do that, and I think there's a lot of support from folks to participate in
that. I think there's more and more, and I think the advocacy groups and the organizers in particular are starting to understand one that a lot of this has been on the backs of the hunters and fishermen, and it's time for, you know, as this group is growing, and if anything, 150 price flattening out at some level, we need to start things become more participatory. Start participating more, excuse me.
Are there any benchmarks from other states on that? How they've been able to do that?
Well, actually, in a number of states, the most common approach is that when you go to buy a license, the first thing you buy is a conservation license, $2 or $4, that's the base. And then you add what you want on top of it.
I think the most successful programs overall have been the excise tax approach that was initiated in Missouri, where all citizens pay a tiny portion of it. Whether their only benefit may be an urban wildlife program or backyard, landscaping or something along those lines. But those are probably, if you look at real dollars, those are probably the programs that have been most productive, most successful.
Well, I was going to add, to me, thinking politically, socioeconomic, a smaller, being broader base,
yes,
is going to be a lot better for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah, otherwise, you've got to put in some back.
The dollars are going to be bigger, depending on smaller, stability is going to be better. The things that are user groups are going to have high balance to get more of the dollars.
So there are several of those models.
When you come back at some point, you're going to some kind of revenue estimate attached to already of options.
Yes, another strategy is looking at how we can enhance our existing fund sources, and very quickly, we do know a lot more now about our constituents. We have in the past. There's a lot more information. This is just some information on anglers. We know the status of angling in the U.S., where the numbers are. We know a lot about who buy our licenses, what segments of the community buy our licenses. And one thing that's certainly gotten our attention has been what's called churn. And in the angling side of it, for example, only 15% of our anglers, people fish wildlife every year. Now, many of them buy them once every 5 years or some period of time. For example, 43% buy them once every 5 years. But the idea would be is probably oversimplified, but you can just send a card, a reminder card, to buy your license, and you can increase your churn by 10% or several million dollars. That's a pretty good investment. And we're about to start on a pilot program trying to do those kinds of things. So we're looking at how we can address that. I think we need one station.
That's right.
I just can't remember. She's in her fourth state of that.
Can you buy a license that you renew every year?
Well, I like it. I like one of those times that you buy it and you just say, we build that. We build everything.
And that's your number for renewal. Do you want to?
We're looking at all of
that. And that's like a reminder card. That's what we're talking about. And that's that's a small investment for a big return. And so we want to look at those things. We need to do that. But the return is there. Hunting side of it is a little more large. They buy a little higher, but there's some of that. We need to look at any place we can. It's just a 40-cent postcard, whatever it is, that's worth it. So we're going to be looking at those.
One of the very most successful programs that Exploring Wildlife has ever entered into, and it's been highly, highly accepted by hundreds of thousands of people across the state, and we have spent probably millions of dollars implementing that since we have had it in place, but we have never charged a dime for it. And that is managed land surplus. Now, I realize managed land surplus is a stretch from the beach to where those items are utilized. And I realize you're just making a presentation here. But it would appear to me that that maybe we need to take a look at that because it's a, while managed land permits is a lot of burden is on the private landowner, but still yet he receives a fruitful bounty for that permit which he receives and is not charged. It would appear to me that there might be some consideration.
We have looked at it. Commissioner, we'd be glad to provide that information to you. There is some opportunity there. Frankly, it's not a large dollar. Our goal in the managed land program is
to get how much you charge for.
Our goal, that's true. Our goal has been improved habitat, and better habitat management implemented at the cost of the landowner. I'm not trying to fit it one way or the other. I'm just going to say the benefits from the program from the wildlife and habitat standpoint have been the focus of the program. Permitting itself, by law, we are allowed to recover our cost of the permit. There are some restrictions there that we have to work with, but we'd be glad to provide those numbers. And it's an area that, yes, we look at.
I want to just clarify real quickly for the new commissioner. We're talking about wildlife management, things like wildlife division, cooperative voluntary closing for landowners to get help. And part of that is to issue managed land deer permits with harvested deer. So that's some context.
Yes, sir.
Chairman,
I think
I'm
going to
take
the reality with this comment, so I'm going to be a new commissioner if I say something that's how we're But going back to the wind farm situation, and it because that's going to take some resources to do studies either before or after. Is it after? How do we avoid the killing of fish or migratory birds or birds along the coast? Is there any way that we could implement some kind of cost to that energy company that would offset the cost that it's going to take for us to look at some of these things and to see how we can continue to preserve our wildlife?
We cannot do that.
We cannot do that. Okay.
The legislature could do that if they have some choice.
And that's part of what being pushed in the battle down south on the coast in Kennedy County is that there should be a permitting process. Which then led to, and I think that's the angle the anti-wind farm group down there is taking. One, the legislature set up a permitting process through the legislature, which would then, and theoretically, could have those kinds of costs in. You go to apply for the permits, you have to pay a certain permit cost, and then the legislature talk to me, then we can be part of the study, and those permitting costs and pay for that study, let's say. But that has to go through the system, and has to go to the they would have to enact it into law. And as you can imagine, that would be a heck of a battle. And I think, again, it gets back to where we are positioned as an agency to stay out of that battle. That's not for us to get involved in.
Mr. Yes, you have some of the very similar, we have some of the very similar. When I get the call, it's a very similar sounding call, whether it's a coal fired plant,
right.
Atomic energy plants, or dam that's going to generate electricity. From a resource standpoint and science standpoint, we need to be looking, I believe our responsibility is, and I believe we all agree, our responsibilities to look for that, that impact. And right now, we're funding the work that we do, whether it's the grocery staff, fishery staff, coastal staff, wildlife staff, are doing is funded by hunters and fishermen. The rescue work, the emergency response work that, that Colonel Flores and his law enforcement people do, being paid for totally by hunting and fishing dollars. So, yes, there are some opportunities there. Certainly, I think we have the opportunity to make a legitimate case to the legislature and say, we are involved in these kinds of things, we need some help. We did that this last session in law enforcement, for example, where we spoke to the time and manpower and equipment used in response, hurricane response and those kind of floods and those kind of things. And they helped us. Order security, homeland security, they provided some general revenue dollars to help. So those opportunities are there. Process that you have to work very, very closely with them all.
Well, I think you're bringing up a good point, Mr. Buckham.
Yes, we have to be aware from the point of view of making sure that there's that, that we're educating legislators that because Florida was requiring us to be involved, that there be funds that help us. Because we're at a point now where we can't keep asking the hunters and fishermen to keep funding things that you can argue aren't that directly related to what they think they're paying for. And so you're making a very good point. I think it's well taken.
It illustrates another point as well, is that in all, we're looking at all these strategies. Some of these strategies, you know, our agency can do. Some of these strategies that will take commission action, and some that will take legislative action, and some of them will take all of them action, so it will be a process. Another area is in fund management, and this is given, for example, with our stand funds. Our dedicated funds and stamps have been really an effective tool to get things done, and certainly very, very popular with our constituents, because they know what's going to happen with those funds, and they get behind them, typically in support of the credit card hatchery, or straight buyback, or migratory birds, whatever it is, they've been there to support those and pay above the line to do those particular activities. And that's been a wonderful addition, the way that we can address things that the other ones could not. But where we've, the things that we've done, unfortunately, not unfortunately, but we've had the luxury, I guess you'd say, over the years to be able to support these special activities with our broader funds to some degree, to be able to absorb some costs that probably should be assigned to those pension funds. And I'm talking about things that biologist that's out there acquiring land or dealing with shrimp buyback licenses or vehicles and their salaries and all that probably should be coming out of these stands, not out of the general fund. We just can't afford it. So we're going to have to be much more disciplined in how we use these stands and make sure that they're paying their full cost. Because at this point, when we're doing activities for one stand for another, it's affecting another user. So we don't want to properly affect an anger to buy. Why we've done a property on our shrimp licenses, by other ones. We want to make sure that there's clear response. Some of that will take some legislative action, but certainly we're going to have to make sure we make best use of those stand funds, because the funds are there, and that's what we're intending to use. Final item is in the license simplification. We started this process last year. This is a House Bill 12 which is requiring us to go back and reassess all of our licenses and report back to the legislature next time we will do that. Fortunately, we already had a start on that process. We went back a year ago and really went through a simplification process. We came to you all with a number of recommendations. I'm happy to say and appreciate the fact that you all have adopted all of those shifts. We've made all those changes that were possible. But there are a number of them, some 27 recommendations that would require legislative action to simplify that process. So we didn't take them forward last time because clearly we were focusing on parks issues. But as we come forward to the next session, this is an opportunity for us to make our license scheme as simple as possible. That certainly can't do anything but help us address some of these issues. So, with that, I would conclude to tell you that in January we'll come back with some specific options. Appreciate any guidance that you do have to help us do that. We'll come back with some options for you all to consider that process. Because although the issue that we're going to deal with doesn't get critical, more or less, until 2011, a few years down the road, the actions in order to, or actions necessary to address those, we have to start now because of the process that we go through. We have to start now or we will not be able to do that. So So that's really why we're in front of you today. Look forward to working with you. Certainly happy to answer any questions. Sorry we took so long on this, but it is an important topic for us.
About your last point there, I want to take one more minute on that. If we are going to address that issue in 2011, that means that additional funds for September 1 of 2011 would have to be, would have to be there. Not maybe they'll be there, or we wish they could be there, but they'll have to be in place. So if you look at implementing a fee increase, let's just say, of some magnitude, whatever, September 1 of 08, those funds would be available and could be looked at, the potential revenue there, as early as the 09 session, which the 09 session will be appropriating money for 11 and 12. So if we're going to do something, we're in a timely fashion, we're on schedule. If we skip this year, typically we would not, the agency would not want to be in the middle of a fee increase during the legislative session. So if we don't do it now, which that's an option, and it's one that you will have to seriously consider. Then probably you're looking at 09 before you start that process back up again.
Does that help you get everybody on the timeline? That's why we need to start bringing
up. We're okay, but it's time to start looking at.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in other words, it needs to be in place by September 1 of 08.
Yes,
sir. Yeah, April's going to go for it. Any other questions or comments for Dr. Jenny or Scott? Thank you all. I know that three rounds have been, very detailed, but they're obviously ready to state audit, sunset, and these fee increases are obviously very, very sensitive. If it's something that the commission has to be very directly involved in, so please, on these fee increases too, if you all are thinking about it, don't hesitate to call Scott or Bob or anybody with either ideas you may have. Okay, you'll probably start hearing from constituents, as you can imagine. Fair enough, and I think the more input we have, the one, we can get more creative, maybe be more dynamic in figuring this out, maybe with some new ideas and thoughts that aren't just based on the traditional way we raise money in the past for conservation.
If we go down this path, it will be an extension. Public involvement. We will want their input. We want them with us on this. We always have had. We always will. The final decision, in order to implement a fee increase September 1 of 08, your decision would have to be made at the latest by the May commission meeting. So we've got 6-7 months here. We can work on this, wrangle it this way or that way.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you all. Committee item number 6, we'll try to move along a little bit now. Approval of projects funded from Texas Parks and Wildlife Conservation Capital Account. Julie Horsford, please.
Good morning, Commissioners. Good morning. My name is I'm here this morning to provide information about the use of funds in the Texas Parks and Wildlife Conservation and Capital Account. I'd like to start off just with some general background on the fund. This is a statutorily dedicated account that consists primarily of allocations of forfeited sales tax and revenues from the sale of our four conservation sites. These include the white tailed deer, the blue bonnet, the horned toad, and the large mouth. Section 11.043 of the Parks and Wildlife Code governs the uses and the revenue sources from this account and provides that money in the account may only be spent on projects that have individually been approved by the commission.
The statute states that preference be given to projects that directly provide hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreational opportunities. But it also goes on to state the allowable uses and provides many examples of those that are pretty broad ranges. For example, it provides that funding could be used to develop and improve facilities for land, for operations and maintenance costs associated with state parks, wildlife, and fisheries projects, and also for efforts to enhance conservation of natural and cultural resources. We did, during this last legislative session, see an increase in the amount of funding that was appropriated to us from the sources that make up this account. The total that was appropriated to us in the general appropriations bill was $6.48 million. Of that total, about $2.92 million consisted of conservation plate balances and revenues. Accumulated account balances accounted for about $2.56 million of that total, and then the remainder, about $1 million, was short good sales tax funds that were allocated into this account. The fiscal year 2008 Commission approved budget, which was adopted in August, reflected a total of $6.45 million from these sources. And the difference there between those two is really just due to some adjustments that were made during the budget process. For example, on the conservation plate, the General Appropriations Act figure includes both balances and revenues that were estimated to be collected in 2008. And in developing the budget, the decision was made not to include those estimated revenues at that time and instead wait until we actually collected them to bring them into the budget. The other main adjustment has to do with fringe benefits, and in the budget figures you see those reflected there. Those amounts aren't actually appropriated to us in the General Appropriations Act. While the overall amount of funding that's shown on this slide was approved by the Commission at the August meeting, the specific listing of projects to be funded from these sources was not provided at that time, which is why we're coming to you now with this project listing for review and approval. And the project listing is included as an exhibit, Exhibit A, in the Commission material. There are just a couple of items that I'd like to point out to you regarding that list. The legislature did provide some direction on how these funds are to be used. For example, the bluebonnet plate funding that we got was directed to be used for purchase of state park transportation items. A portion of the account balances for the sales tax allocation was directed to infrastructure support costs and SDGs related to the state parks exceptional items. And House Bill 12 provisions in Article 9 of the Appropriations Act directs that a little bit over $2 million in account 504 balances be directed to state park minor repair costs. As you look through the listing and the exhibit, you'll see these items laid out there as well as others. The total for the identified projects in the list is about $5.8 million. And that the bulk of that is associated with projects in infrastructure, state parks, wildlife, and inland divisions. And there's about 696,000 that's being held of whitetail deer and horned toad plate, 2009 projects that's going to be carried forward into fiscal year 2009. This last slide just basically shows the recommended motion that we'll be bringing to you tomorrow for approval. It basically just asks for your approval of the projects that are listed as shown. And that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy
to
answer any questions.
Which plate fell to us?
It's the
horned
toad.
Not the blue line, is it?
No,
the
blue line is
second. Yeah. Okay. Any questions for Julie? Thank you. If there are no further questions, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. So we will include an action item for tomorrow. Thank you, Judy. Committee item number 7, equipment and maintenance provider review system rules. Ms. Ann Bright. This is exciting. You lucky person, you get to do this.
Right. I know the fact that this is exciting to me. I'll give it a shot. One of the things that you're going to hear about a lot, and you've already heard about, is HB 12. That was an omnibus bill that was passed towards the end of the session. It dealt with a lot of parks and wildlife issues. One of the things that was included in this bill was the requirement that we establish two types of systems. One is an equipment review system, and the other one is a maintenance provider review system. The equipment review system requires the department annually review maintenance equipment to determine if it's become outdated, and then the outdated equipment is to be sold as surplus. Maintenance equipment is equipment that's used to maintain the real property, and the rule that we propose, that the commission is proposing, would apply only to maintenance equipment that is capitalized. That means it has an acquisition value of $5,000 or more. The reason for that is that we have restrictions on the purchase of capitalized equipment. We do not have similar restrictions on lesser value properties. So, in other words, if we have a property that's outdated and it's got a value of less than $5,000, it's a lot easier for us to get rid of that equipment than it is for an actual replacement than equipment over $5,000. Under the proposed rules, equipment will be considered outdated if it is, one, no longer operational, it cannot reasonably be made operational, or no longer serves the department purpose. And I think both of those are pretty self-explanatory. Or three, it has to meet all three of these criteria. It has a fair market value that is less than the cost to repair the equipment. That the cost to replace the equipment is less than the maintenance cost. And we have sufficient funds and budget authority available to replace the equipment. The idea here is that while often it may cost more than a piece of equipment is worth to repair it, it would cost us even more to replace it. And we want to get rid of that equipment only if we're going to be able to replace it. And we want to make sure we have sufficient funds and authority to do that. Under the proposed rules, the agency will annually prepare a report regarding outdated maintenance equipment. If equipment is outdated, we will begin the process within 60 days of disposing of the equipment, and that is handled through an established procedure. And we will dispose of property otherwise pursuant to other procedures. For example, this isn't going to replace our normal process of getting rid of surplus property. The other part of this process is a maintenance provider review system, and this has to do not with the equipment, but with the people that are actually performing the maintenance services. Under the proposed rules, the department will annually identify the cost of staff to perform maintenance tasks like custodial, mowing, landscaping, minor repairs, trash collection, and the cost of contracting with a third party to perform those tasks, and whether the quality of the result is going to be at least equal to or better than the cost of having it performed by staff. For example, one of the things Walt is telling me, and I mentioned this last time, at Garner State Park during the summer, we have staff that do nothing but clean the bathrooms. They finish a bathroom and they just keep going until they're clean. And they start all over again. If we have somebody who wants to come out and who says they can come out and clean the bathrooms for us, but they're only going to come out once a week, that's not going to be sufficiently quality. That's not going to be enough quality to satisfy us. And under the proposed rules, if the cost of contracting with a third party is less than the cost of us performing the job ourselves with our staff, and we're going to get a better quality, or at least equal to a better quality, then we're going to begin the process of going out and contracting with a third party to perform that task. We received 7 comments on these rules, and only 2 of them were in disagreement. One comment was really not germane. It just basically said that we needed to take care of our equipment and exercise safety precautions, which we will do. And the other one was they recommended that vendors not have control of our equipment, which they wouldn't anyway, and that we include tree trimming services, and we believe that's included in landscaping, which is one of the items we're going to seek information from vendors for. And this is the recommendation that we will be presenting to you tomorrow.
Any questions, Rand? And we are looking at doing more contracting and trying to find areas where we can bring in more concessionaires and do those kinds of things. Walt and his group are very strong as part of this overall audit, and everything we're looking at is a more opportunity. You know, it sounds easy, but remember, concessionaires are in business to make a profit. So certainly there has to be enough business there where they feel they not only can move in and take over whatever it may be, and they can make some money from it. And so it's not quite as easy as it sounds sometimes relative to the volume of things that we do in parks particularly. And thank you. Let's see. no more discussion or questions, I'll place this item on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 8, party boat regulations. Mr. Allen Thompson.
Commissioners,
Mr.
Party boats or charter boats, they're basically the same. They're boats that are rented for hire. And they've been under regulation for years on the coast or on coastal waters, but there has been no regulation on inland waters, and it's been a big concern with high-profile accidents around the country. And the states are going to get on board and do some regulations. So House Bill 12 was passed, and it defined party boats as boats that are rented or leased for more than 6 passengers and that operate on inland waters. Because we already have the regulations on coastal waters. Now, these regulations are not going to apply for boats that are less than 30 feet in length, sailboats, livery vessels that are under the command of the renter for the whole time. So these are going to be, it's going to apply if there's a captain or somebody that's in charge of the boat or the constituents. Also, any vessels that are used for training purposes. And other than what's covered in statute, what we're proposing is a rule that is going to add the process to do an annual inspection, which is required by statute. The annual inspection would be conducted by, for example, by a game warden or a third party that was contracted if we choose to do so. We would look at safety measures that are in place, that have to be in place, so that boat passes the inspection. We would look at passenger capacity limits that would have to be in detail, and we would also inspect that they have a liability insurance in place. So that's the annual inspection. The other big thing is going to be the operator licensing. An operator to operate and carry these passengers for hire is going to have to be at least age 21. It requires that they have some experience and that they pass a written exam, which would be precluded by having a boating safety exam that we already have. We did receive some comments, five comments on the rule and then five on the fee that we set. The ones that were of any relevance are waiving the fee for the annual inspection if the boat is inspected by a federal entity, and that is already incorporated into the rules, so we have that one covered. And then another comment that was relevant was the belief that $300,000 was not sufficient liability insurance for one of these boats. We did a feasibility or a business study on these, and a lot of times they're insured as a group of boats. For example, somebody will have 10 boats, and they may spend $3,000 as a cost for insuring the one boat, but it actually covers many boats, when you couldn't actually go out and insure one boat by itself for $300,000. So that's what we'll be proposing tomorrow. It's our call for this. If you have any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions or discussion. I'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you. Item number 9, local park grant rule amendment.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. I'm Tim Hoffett from the Recreation Grants Branch and State Parks Division. This is the kickoff of the formalization of the process of rewriting rules for the park grant administration of the park grant programs. The commission has the legislative authority to make rules under Chapter 24 of the Parks and Wildlife Code, the fourth program. And rules, as far as the staff is concerned, are the administrative processes we use, but primarily the scoring system, the criteria that we use to review applications, since there are always more applications than we have funding resources for. And then the application of that scoring system is that we will, after you adopt the scoring system, we will review applications and bring those forward to you in terms of recommendations for funding. The last session of the legislature really restored our grant program to where we were in fiscal year 2002-2003. We've been appropriated approximately $15.5 million a year for each of the next two fiscal years, fiscal year 08 and 09. And those are for competitive grants. As a result of that restoration of funding, we feel that it's important that we go out to our customers and come to you to seek guidance as well for making new rules or just looking over the process by which we make grants available. For the new members, I'd like to take just a couple of seconds and talk about each of these grant program opportunities. The Outdoor Recreation Grant Program is the traditional and oldest grant program that we have. These are all programs which are funded through the dedication sporting goods sales tax. Outdoor recreation grants are typically either active kinds of projects or things such as ball fields or swimming complexes, but can also be for conservation acquisition and conservation kinds of projects, including very passive sorts of recreation. They're matching funds, grants to local governments, 50% match, requires the match be available at the time of the application submission. Indoor recreation grants, very similar, grants to the local governments at 50% for indoor recreation facilities. That can vary from anything such as the typical indoor recreation center you see in an urban environment, gymnasium, in the indoor swimming pool, those kinds of things, all the way to conservation kinds of projects involving buildings that interpret natural resources, such as natural learning centers, that kind of facility. Community outdoor outreach grants, these are the only grants that we administer which are not brick and mortar or construction and acquisition grants. These are program grants, small grants that don't require a match of up to $30,000 to either local governments or nonprofits to introduce people to the outdoors, to introduce traditionally underserved populations like youth at risk, that kind of thing, to parks and wildlife facilities, but also just in general to outdoor recreation and outdoor experiences. Regional park grants, these are large grants. These have been on suspension for the last couple of years with the funding cuts that we endured last couple legislative sessions. These were, when we were doing them, were up to $2 million grants to large projects, either large conservation or large recreation projects that typically involve multiple partners, several government entities or public and private partnerships. We have and will hopefully be continuing the small community grant program, small matching grants of up to $50,000 to small communities with populations of 20,000 or less. Very popular program that often provides the first park facilities in smaller communities. And then finally, a new program that I'm going to talk about in a minute that was created, carved out of, if you will, the legislative appropriation, exclusively for large communities of 500,000 or more. The review process that we're going through, culminating in hopefully a presentation to you for adoption of new rules in January, we've done staff retreat, we've done a survey, an online survey of our customers. We held 5 public hearings around the state, had about 250 people attend those. They were mostly our traditional customers, people that we do business with daily. And then for the Urban Park Grant new program that we're going to need to pull together rules on, we did an Urban Park Summit. There are 13 eligible sponsors for that program, so we pulled in the directors of those parks departments. Brought them together and facilitated the environment and did a two-day-long draft rulemaking process with them basically hopefully helping us write the rules for their program. I won't focus too much on this slide other than that the bottom pie indicates that there is an amount of sporting goods sales tax that's dedicated to park grants, and that by law now is split into two pieces. with 60% of the money going to what we call our traditional Texas Recreation and Parks account. It's the balance of the state of all sponsors who are not specifically eligible for the new Urban Park Grant Program. And that Urban Park Grant Program will be allocated 40%. So 9.3 million approximately for TRPA and about 6.2 million annually for the Urban Park Grants. The issues that we don't really anticipate as a result of the public testimony and public input that we've gotten so far that we're going to be recommending dramatic changes in either the scoring systems or administrative processes. We took a look at the ranking systems for all programs, and we also looked at the administrative practices, things such as annual deadlines, how many times a year we take applications. We looked at the efficiency of which people are using money and are going to probably be proposing some tougher guidelines in terms of administration and use of and expenditures of those funds. In the area of priority ranking systems, a few things that did pop out at us with both our own review and with review as we were dealing with our customers. We are probably going to recommend that we allow or use some outside review expertise. At one time, I, for example, had a staff member who was a professional engineer who could review cost figures for applications for the cost of the facility that was being proposed. I've lost that position, and I feel that it's necessary if we can get someone from the outside to give us some real-life current cost figures to take a look at the costs relative to applications. Also, want to be able to maybe consult with people like the recreation profession, maybe universities, looking at recreation trends. Recreation is always like any thing, is a changing situation. There are new kinds of outdoor recreation and indoor recreation opportunities coming online. A few years ago it was skate parks. Now it's things like geocaching and all kinds of new recreation trends. We want to be sure that our program stays current. We're looking at evaluating, possibly increasing the amount of priority points given for environmentally responsible activities. And that's really green construction kinds of projects. We want to take a look, as always, at the amount of weight and priority given to conservation. We understand that it's the key mission of the agency, conservation and recreation, but that we want to be sure that there are high priorities given to projects which have high and important natural resource conservation activities. We have a piece of the scoring system in place that currently rewards sponsors for doing local parks and recreation master planning, and then coming forward with applications which ask for their high priority local needs. We're taking a look at the relative weight of how much credit or how much priority those are given. One of the attributes of the scoring system is recreational diversity. Applicants that ask for more than one kind of recreation opportunity and will provide more than one sort of facility are given higher priority. One of the flaws that we have in our current system, in our view, is that equal weight is sometimes given for less expensive facilities to larger facilities. An example might be that an equal competitive score in this particular criteria would be given for something small, like maybe a horseshoe pit or a volleyball court, as opposed to a major recreation facility. And we're going to try to find a way to categorize those a little better and make that recreational diversity make a little more sense. We have some programming related points in our scoring system, specifically as they relate to youth at risk. We give additional priority currently to projects that will target youth at risk. Some of what we heard through our customers as we were doing these public hearings was they didn't really feel like that was an appropriate or proper response to what they were doing. In other words, they didn't really feel that necessarily it was our role to be in the programming area, that we were really more providing dollars for brick and mortar and parks, and that it was up to them to make the programming kinds of decisions. in terms of administrative practices, we're seeing a trend, unfortunately, of some projects that are struggling, failing to meet all the goals. And we think that part of that can be addressed through tighter administration on our part as staff. But we also feel like that there ought to be some punitive measures, if you will, that the commission has in its toolbox to be able to allow staff to, if a sponsor truly has not done well for the administration of the grant that they've gotten, that it would either make them ineligible or at least maybe reflect in some negative scoring in the criteria that they have. Again, the idea is we've got very limited funds, we've got extremely high rates of competition, and this was very well received, by the way, in the public hearing. Everybody pretty much was unanimously in favor that, yeah, if you're going to get money to us, that we've got to responsibly spend it and we need to be held accountable for it. We're looking at the possibility of renewal of more than one annual deadline for a couple of programs. We would scale back, for example, the Outdoor Recreation Grant Program from two annual reviews to one as a result of less funding being available. Same thing on the Community Outdoor Outreach Program. We're looking at recommending that you allow us to take applications more than once a year on those two programs. Again, that was well received. Funding ceilings, same kind of thing. We reduced the amount of money that people could ask for in several of the programs as a result of increased funding overall available. And we're going to look at recommending that you allow us to bump those funding request ceilings back up a little bit higher with $15.5 million a year available. Real quick on the Urban Park Grant Program. Again, the legislature carved out 40% of the money that we get annually for an exclusive competition for the 13 largest cities and counties in Texas to compete only among themselves for. And that's who you would expect. It's Austin, San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, El Paso. And then the counties in which those reside, that makes 12. And then you add Hidalgo County, which is McAllen area in Rio Grande Valley. They will be helping us develop a scoring system and rules that we will propose to you for adoption that will be strictly for them and for their programs. And we expect to have mirror programs for that piece of the pie, if you will. An outdoor recreation grant program for them, an indoor recreation grant program for them, some community outdoor outreach money for them. So that's really new territory for us. It was really interesting as we did the hearings for the folks that were not eligible for this, the 60% balance of the state. Most of the folks were encouraged by this. They felt like that it would set aside some money just for them, for the big guys, and then they would sort of be out of the way, if you will. Having said that, we will be happy to talk with any of you individually, get you whatever information you like in terms of what we're going to be proposing. Obviously, this will be posted in the Texas Register. We'll receive formal comment through that process, but we'd be more than happy to visit with any of you individually to answer any questions you might have or take any advice and counsel that you might have. So tomorrow we will be asking you for permission to post in the Texas Register and proceed with the process going forward with hopefully bringing something back in January. I'm going to do that real quickly. Be glad to answer any questions.
Is there any advantage to a group in the foreign system if they have matching dollars?
We require matching dollars to be in place at the time of the application, and there is an advantage in the current scoring system to, if the match comes from outside of the sponsor themselves, to promote cooperative agreements. For example, if two governments work together and both provide part of the match, or if there's public and private partnership on the match, then they definitely get a higher priority.
And yes, sir.
A couple of questions. I appreciate the program's not broken. It just wasn't fun. It's not broken too much, but I think it will help you review. Just one comment. I agree that we probably ought to stay away from eight items which are
Yeah, we have a very limited ability to go back and see what they're doing. There's nobody to hold that bill.
But a question related is, how do we discuss the way that the uses are projected to factor that into this ordinance?
Currently, really the only use or need criteria is the criteria that involves the master plan. The local government goes through the process of determining what their high priority local needs are based on, I'm assuming, things like use and resources available. But we don't have a current scoring criteria or really a method currently where we can look at how much existing parks are being used.
So one park in one city in the Port of Vancouver can help you Riverside. Scores higher, it's got a bunch of attributes that make the score higher. If one person really would get a grant over one that might get 10,000 people, you're able to have two fewer attributes.
In theory. In theory.
Yeah.
I think this split of urban versus the rest of the state will approach that somewhat in that obviously the sponsors that are eligible for those urban grant funds are dealing with a much smaller area with a whole lot more people in them. But we've never really gotten into the business of need based on numbers of users. We've left that as a local, a process that comes up through the local process, the review process.
I think Tim would be safe to say that if a community, large or small, is going to put their match, they're weighing that usage and that need and that demand as they say we're going to commit $100,000 to this project or $50,000
yeah.
This is a small community.
Those local elected officials have the accountability for what they propose and how they spend the money in terms of getting it justified.
I think that's the only way that
I
can
we've talked about that as staff a little bit. And we'll kick that around a little more and see if there's some way that we can look at a usage.
I think real estate program appreciates the ability people have to employee protection.
Yeah, we don't want a rule from above, that probably it's be part of the question process.
I think it's extreme, though, and it would be nice to find some way to factor that in a little bit.
We'll take a look at it.
The other question I've got is, can we or do we score in favor TPWD prioritize recreational sports? And we are not advocating trying to build up an active recreational sports in the park system, not in the park system. You mentioned a whole lot of other, several other
things.
We had a letter to the legislation. We wanted to do higher weights in those things.
Recreation.
Well, yeah, take it out and take our broad vision, but hunting, fishing, biking, birding,
conservation,
well, our broad vision, the things we're getting the most funding, the most support here, how the drug program was started.
I honestly believe that even our existing system brings conservation and mission-driven kinds of projects to a higher priority, but that's definitely one of the things that we have discussed with our customers, and one of the things that we're looking at possibly increasing scoring for. And this is not the first commission group that has made that comment, and we have continued to reflect up-ramping the priority given to mission-oriented kinds of results and projects.
The other question is, how does our system work? Programs that have a strategic regional impact, even if they're in the form of a program. It's active usage for the facility that might really have a much broader impact, just a local community impact, even though it's in the community.
That was the focus of our regional park grants we were doing. Those were the larger grants that we were doing, things like helping build a trail along the Rio Grande River in El Paso. 40 to 60 miles long initially, or doing the major access to Trinity River in Arlington as part of the Trinity River corridor. That's the best way I think we address it, by bringing that program back online, which we hope to be able to do. Beyond that, things in the scoring system that relate to multiple partners involved in the match, or the match comes from outside resources, that maybe addresses it.
Since we're sitting here on the local program, I'm going to think about waiting, giving some way two factors which broaden the impact or broaden the availability or broaden the people outside of that.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, communities that might have partnered teaching a bigger project, more projects, at least a bigger project, but under one of the smaller grant programs.
So, a sponsor in an application would tell why that project is blocking into each of the larger overall recreation planning efforts.
Yeah.
Okay. Take a look at it.
Yeah. We could leverage it.
The extent that they're funding a lot of it, but that might get them out of their town mission. I don't know. Let me look at them.
In these urban environments, so,
I think that does happen frequently. For instance, any kind of connection with the trail system or the river system that connects two parks or connects two communities. You really, really think about the little Luling paddling trail and all that. That brings two communities together in a project. There is a conversation area and everybody out there. We encourage those kind of projects.
And so does the existing scoring system gives some additional priority to linking projects. It gives additional priority to where, again, the match involves multiple jurisdictions cooperating for part of the match. Green belts and those kinds of corridors are typically higher score projects.
They have a factor there. I have a question along the parents' point. Do I remember how it appears that being a large rural match including more communities or disadvantaged relative to wealthier communities? What would you mean?
Always we have allowed in-kind contributions to part of the match, whether it be work that the city or county can do with their own resources, building roads or building parking lots, or other governments can bring to the table and supplement, and also donations of labor, equipment, materials from the private sector can be leveraged and be a part of the match. And again, those kinds of projects are higher priority projects in that criteria scoring system, and that they're providing part of the match from other than just coming out of the budget of the city or the county that's submitting the application.
Okay, what criteria are you using for evaluating that? What's the rigor in evaluation?
In-kind contributions, if it comes directly to the sponsors based on the value of the labor, equipment, and materials, based on what they can justify to us through their accounting process. Labor, based on what they pay them, equipment based on, unless they have an auditable set of equipment rates, payment equipment rates, materials based on whatever their stock value is. And we thoroughly audit that to ensure that the reimbursement is based on that and it's the substantiation.
Any questions for Tim? Okay. I will authorize staff to publish this item in the text register for the required public comment period. For the next item 10. Approval of National Recreation and Trail Grant Funding ends up again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, and the Director of Tim Hoffman, Recreation Grant State Parks Division. This is going to be proposing funding for an off-road vehicle trail in Crockett County, which is close to the city of Ozona, West Texas. This particular site is about 3,300 acres, and it's 20 miles or so southwest of the city of Ozona, and 5 or 6 miles to the south of I-10. Why are we in this business? Well, we have a federal funding pass-through that provides us resources for trail. Included in that is a requirement that 30% of that federal money be dedicated to off-road vehicle trail opportunities. That's because of the funding resource for those federal aid. It's gas tax generated on off road vehicle use. We've had traditionally not a lot of sponsors for this program, and so we've been able to fund a little more freely the applications we've had with less competition than we've had in our non-motorized trail program. We're also in this business because of the legislative mandate. 78th legislature took this kind of activity out of stream beds with a couple of exceptions. Took the ability to use our stream beds for off-road vehicle traffic. At the same time, it directed us, Senate Bill 155 directed us to begin to develop plans and eventually facilities to compensate for that, to provide opportunities for these folks to participate in the recreation that they enjoy. The next session of the legislature enacted a specific program where we are allowed to sell stickers to off-road vehicles, and at least theoretically that money comes back to us and can be used to supplement these federal grant funds, again, to provide opportunities for off-road vehicle recreation. It's a legitimate form of recreation. The legislature has told us that we need to help foster that kind of recreation. This specific project came to us in 2005. It was really pretty controversial when it came in. It was originally the acquisition of this property in West Texas, 3,323 acres. Frankly, there was a lot of adjacent landowner opposition to this. See, this big map, the yellow square is the property. The yellow name tags, if you will, are adjacent landowners. And they were really all pretty much opposed to this. Came before the commission when we brought this application to you the first time before the land acquisition, and what's their opposition. We then worked with them, had some public hearings out there, brought it back as an acquisition project. They were still opposed, but you granted us the authority to go ahead and allow a nonprofit who was the sponsor of this, Texas Motorized Trail Coalition, to be granted the money to acquire this property, contingent upon that no use of it or development of it would occur until we had gone through the process of thoroughly vetting this project with that community and with the adjacent landowners by doing a formal management plan of the facility. We've since done that. The land was bought in 2006. It's closed down, not currently publicly accessible. The management plan has been done. We have conducted public hearings in Arizona. We have met with each and every individual landowner. I can't tell you that they are totally happy with it. I don't think that they would ever totally be happy with it. But I think that they are convinced that this will be a good neighbor kind of relationship, and that this group, Texas Motorized Trail Coalition, have a proven track record with another site near Gilmer in North Texas, and that they are and can be, will be good stewards and good neighbors. We'll obviously be continually closely monitoring as development begins, if you give us permission to make this grant for the development portion of this project. It's a little difficult to see, but there is a map showing the proposed road trails, if you will, within this 3,300 acre site. We have done environmental assessment in terms of protected species issues, archaeological issues. We feel the plan that is proposed will take those issues into account adequately. Again, we've reviewed the management plan and hopefully answered the adjacent landowners' questions as well as the community's questions on things such as law enforcement, fire protection, and other issues that came up in the review process. So having said that, tomorrow we are going to, Saturday is going to be our, yes sir.
Tim, I think it's real important, particularly for the new commissioners, that you speak to the landowner that this property was bought from was a willing seller. He was very, very supportive, very, very helpful through the process, and just a little bit of history, the local community
County Commissioners Court to City Council, as I recall, were supportive throughout and continue to work with us. And, you know, this has been a long and quite frankly a difficult process, but I think the community is going to pull together better and it will be okay.
I do as well.
I want to point out that middle of the cellar thing, that's an important one to us. Yes.
So I think the chamber, did the chamber there approve that also?
Yes.
They were looking at the forefront of bringing this thing forward. Absolutely. It's looked at as very much an economic development issue for that community.
Right.
Yeah. That was the Gilmer model was very much that way. In fact, we produced a video that we'd be glad to share with you where we went and interviewed folks in Gilmer, neighboring landowners, neighbors to this other park that this group, TNTC, has. Interviewed the county sheriff, the Chamber of Commerce, interviewed the neighboring landowners, and really, they were very turned around in their opinion after having experience living next to that facility for a couple of years. And we hope it's be, you know, very much the same model.
Good.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah. I'm finished here.
Any questions for Jim? One we will be voting on tomorrow. Okay. So a discussion on place this item on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And thank you. You're up one more time for the item number 11, local park grant funding for projects identified by appropriation item.
This one should be short. As part of the appropriations process, we received, as I mentioned earlier, $15.5 million a year for competitive grant funds for the next 2 years. On top of that, the legislature gave us a list, if you will, of 18 projects for about $16.8 million. They said these projects in these communities, you will give grants to, matching grants, and you need to move forward from there. We're bringing tomorrow two of those to you, one from the city of Houston and the other from City Weslaco. The Weslaco project, and let me say this, I honestly believe that we will make really good recreational projects out of all of these riders, as we call them, these 18 projects. In spite of the fact that the legislature has given us specific guidance on where to put the money, all of them will meet the requirements of the program. They will require match, and I think we can, through working with them closely, might not have been necessarily the most competitive projects, but they will be good, solid outdoor and indoor recreation projects at the end of the day. The Weslaco project is for the construction of a 7,000-foot building, nature center, small nature center in the city that they plan to use this as the focus of their interpretive efforts for that nature center. This is the largest single appropriations rider. There's a piece of property in northwest Houston, just inside the loop, that was owned by the school district, 20 acres of property, right in the middle of an older subdivision. It's an island of green within a subdivision. And the school district needed to divest themselves of the property. The city has already, through the Houston Parks Board, acquired 15 of the 20 acres. And they were, the legislative appropriation is to complete that with quite expensive but quite important filling out of that green space and putting it into public trust. So that's what this project is about. And we're going to be requesting that you endorse these projects and allow staff to enter into contracts.
Yeah.
In your presentation before on the grants, you put a number of $15.5 million. And in this presentation, you have a number of $16 million.
Okay. It's $15.5 million a year for each of the next 2 years. That's the two 15.5 plus on top of that, so $31 million. Plus an additional $16 million for these appropriation riders.
Is there additional riders? Okay.
This is $47-48 million of new park money for grants for local parks.
Okay.
Of which is that 31 about will be within the competitive process.
Right.
How are you moving? I mean, how are you doing time wise on the 18 stipulated spot budget?
I've met or talked personally with all the two of them. And we're going through, we've got the next two full fiscal years in the legislation to enter into contracts for those. And my hope is we will have all of those before you, if not most of them, if not all of them, in this 08 year.
Yeah, 08 year. Okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're all unique. They're all challenging. They all require some special attention and guidance.
Jim is so good.
Yeah, he has to be in the job he did. And I do compliment you. A lot of times, a lot of push and pull and a lot of politics.
This is really the only place that politics has ever entered into this program.
Yeah, but other than that, it's been competitive.
Yes, sir.
It's been a pretty good process, really.
This isn't the first time this has happened, though, sir. It happened in previous legislative sessions. This is absolutely the first time it's ever happened in this degree.
Yeah. Not much.
Yeah.
Usually it has been one or two projects here and there.
I think
the important thing again, folks, the direction of the legislature, we're going to make these good projects. We're going to make them solid. We're going to try to keep them conservation oriented and supportive to the community.
The ledge gave us additional money to do these tools in that session. That might not be the case in future sessions. But this time, I mean, we were restored to where we were at what we call full funding, 15 and a half million a year. So
that
and
that output. Yeah. We'll keep trying to get that done for you. Yeah. Any other questions or comments, Dan? Okay, with that, we'll place this item on third, the commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Is there any other business we brought before this committee, Mr. Cook?
Okay,
thank you, Tim. Appreciate it. Unless there's any other discussion, the committee has completed business. We'll move on to conservation committee, but I think what we'll do is break 12:30 and for lunch and what executive session is that? Correct. Am I saying all that right?